do not have a quorum yet, but we're going to start. We do not have a quorum yet, but we're going to start the testimony, so we... So we're going to start with the health department, and Dr. Ellinger is here, and if you look at the spreadsheet, it's on the last page, upside down. You start with the Department of Health. Welcome to the committee, Dr. Ellinger, and welcome, Dave Greenman.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Ed Ellinger, the Commissioner of Health for the Minnesota Department of Health, and thank you for this opportunity to come and explain our budget for proposals for this year. As you know, the Minnesota Department of Health is the lead public health agency in the state of Minnesota with the mission of protecting and improving the health of all Minnesotans. We do that in three major ways. First, by assessing the health status, the health risks, and the opportunities for improving health among all Minnesotans. Secondly, by advancing policies and programs that create the conditions in which people can be healthy. And thirdly, by monitoring, evaluating, regulating, and when appropriate, delivering services that advance our mission. As we learn more about what determines health and recognize that chronic diseases rather than acute and infectious diseases are our biggest challenge, we recognize the need to change the narrative in our state about what creates health and build a health department that advances policy, systems, and environmental changes that provide everybody the opportunity to be healthy. We know we have an excellent medical care system. I think it's the best in the country. But we also know that we can't treat our way into good health. To really improve health and reduce costs, we need to rebalance our investments in both treatment and prevention and address the health disparities that we have in our state. That's the only way that we will really be able to realize the maximum potential of all of the residents of Minnesota. And the funding and the support that you gave us in the last session really helped us in rebalancing that treatment and prevention. The funding for SHIP and some of our core public health services has helped us move closer to our goals of having the healthiest state in the country. And so I appreciate the support and look forward to working with you this year and in the years to come on advancing that mission. As you know, this is a non-budget year, so we have limited requests. Our focus has really been on items that need to be addressed this year to keep us moving forward. While these proposals are not big and exciting as those we would advance in a regular budget year, yet they are nonetheless important. And so we appreciate your consideration of these. Dave Greenman, our budget director, is here to go through the proposals, and we also have other staff available if there are any other questions that you have about any of the proposals. Dave.
Mr. Chair, Dave Greenman, Budget Director with the Health Department. I'm here today to present the Governor's 2014 Supplemental Budget Proposals. We have five proposals. I'll be walking through them using the budget pages that were provided, I believe, in your packet. I will start with the proposal dealing with integrated licensing for home care and home and community-based services. This proposal creates an integrated licensing system for providers who deliver both home care services licensed by the health department and home and community-based services licensed by the Department of Human Services. Even though these two types of services may sound like the same thing, they're different. They provide different levels of care, different types of services, and are subject to different types of standards. Currently, there are about 200 providers in the state who deliver both home care and home and community-based services. Without a change in this law, in the statute, these providers would be subject to having to get two separate licenses to operate. During the 2013 legislative session, the legislature directed both of the departments to develop a study and develop some recommendations on an integrated licensing system that would require only one license for these two types of for these providers, and to make recommendations and present a report in February of 2014 with sample or draft legislation. This proposal represents those recommendations. Under this proposal, effective July 1, 2015, home care providers licensed by the health department would be able to obtain a home and community-based services designation, also through the health department, that would enable these providers to deliver home and community-based services, provided they meet certain home and community-based services standards. Under this proposal, providers would have to work with only one agency. They would have less of an administrative burden, and it would be less expensive for them than having to get two separate licenses. This proposal does require an initial designation fee, a flat fee for the for becoming designated, and then a annual fee for at renewal based on the size of the provider. This is funded through the state government special revenue fund, and fee revenues and costs balance out over time as required by statute.
That is not general fund money, it's just the fees.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. It's state government special revenue fund.
Any questions? Well, why don't you proceed, Mr. Yeah. Greenman?
The second budget proposal is with our food, pools, and lodging regulations. This proposal appropriates $670,000 in fiscal year 14 and $648,000 per year thereafter to cover the cost of regulating food, pool, and lodging establishments in the city of St. Paul. The department assumed responsibility for this activity in July of 2013. There's no fee increase associated with this proposal. The fee revenue currently being generated from these establishments will offset the cost of the appropriation increase. The funding will be used to support 7 additional FTEs to inspect 1,200 restaurants and food, beverage, and lodging establishments in the city. The additional staff will ensure the safety of food being served in these restaurants and other food events, will respond to food safety emergencies, will ensure that pools and lodging establishments are clean and sanitary, and will respond to safety and sanitary complaints within the city. Without this appropriation, the department would not be able to perform licensing and inspection activities in St. Paul without compromising regulation in other Minnesota jurisdictions.
So their previous license fees would have gone to the county?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Previously, the county collected the license fees and did the regulations. The city actually collected the license fees and did the regulations. The department's been doing it since July of 13, and so we've been collecting the license fees. We need to come to the legislature to get the appropriation to actually get the fee revenue.
Okay. Any other questions on that item? I don't see any, so Mr. Greenman, continue.
Okay. The third proposal is for our spoken language interpreter program. This proposal increases the appropriation from the state government special revenue fund to the Department of Health to maintain the spoken language interpreter roster. The increase is $48,000 per year. The department's maintained the roster as required by statute since 2009. Participation in the roster is voluntary. However, a 2011 law requires that for services to be covered under the medical assistance program, an interpreter must be enrolled in the roster. As a result, the enrollment in the roster has increased from just under 140 to over 3,200 in a few short years. The initial appropriation for this program was $21,000. It's not been changed since it was created, and it's not increased with the cost of the program. The current fee is $50 per year. As a result, the program collects significantly more than more fee revenue than we are appropriated, and the appropriation does not cover the cost of the program, which includes electronic registration and fee payment operations for interpreters, a website where the public can search for interpreters and get in from and identify them, and staff support to help interpreters sign up for the registry and change any information they may have. One of the things we expected when we started this program was that some of the interpreters may need some assistance with signing up for the program, or signing up to the roster, given that a number of them probably don't speak English as their first language. We have had a higher level of need than expected, and so that's created some of the need for this additional appropriation. In addition, the roster doesn't currently provide information to consumers about the quality of the services being provided. Consumers don't have an ability to sort of compare interpreters. We have received some complaints about some of the quality of services. The appropriation increase would be used to collect and display more information about the training, the qualifications, and the education of the interpreters. This appropriation is essentially designed to keep the program running as it currently exists. It doesn't do anything to expand the program beyond what it's currently providing. the fee revenue that we're electing will cover the costs of the appropriation increase, so we're not asking for a fee increase.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and morning.
Morning.
So, excuse me if I'm not totally tracking this. We had kind of a late night last night, but one of the reasons we had a late night was because we heard about this particular bill that relates to this issue that we're talking about this morning, and I just wanted to, excuse me if you already said this, but, you know, how much is in the fund? And I know that, let me just back up, part of I think the bill that was under development, that is under development, was to use some additional money that's in this fund to make changes to support the new system. And, you know, it appears we're not going to be able to do that this year. The bill needs more work and obviously more buy-in from a lot of stakeholders, and that's all fine. But I just want to see if there's still going to be funding in the fund. With, you know, this appropriation is fine, but you said it's not making changes to the program, but are we still going to have that money there when we, if we get to the point where we need to make changes, more IT changes? Because I know that was sort of the thought, that there was money there to make the changes that mm-hmm. we might need to do to actually have what I would call a more robust system of having people be able to find and hire interpreters.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, as I mentioned and as you noted, the appropriation that we're asking for is only to keep the program operating and moving forward as it currently exists. We have certainly heard about proposals that are out there and more than happy to work with members and all stakeholders on the proposals. We at this time, we're only asking for an appropriation to keep the program running as it currently operates. So I think every 2 years, the department presents a departmental earnings report that takes a look at the revenues and expenditures from our fee programs, and we use that to sort of decide whether, we do need to keep a balance. If it's out of balance, we need to look at what the options are, and obviously that's a legislative decision, but we certainly expect that the fee revenue is because of the growth in the program, there is quite a bit of fee revenue coming in. So if there are sort of alternative things people want to do, we'd certainly be willing to work with them on that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Schumacher.
Pass.
Schumacher.
I'm done.
Oh.
That was
okay. Representative Abler.
I'm frightened, Mr. Chair, when Representative Liebling and Representative Schumacher are doing telepathic questioning. we had a very, shall we say, a robust hearing last night on the topic of translators, and that's a nice way to say it. It was sort of a melee for a while there. But I think that it's time for the department to lead on this and not just have a proposal as mild as this. Perhaps the commissioner would like to listen to the tape last night and listen to the testimony of the various individuals. There's money in the fund that I would suggest that before we get to our finance bill, either you can write it or I'll write it for you, a plan to convene a work group and actually a very large and engage all 3,000 or 5,000 people. Well, the people last night were terrified, thinking they were going to lose their job. And there was problems in the interpreter arena, which is actually under your watch. And so the problems are on your watch. The resolution could be on your watch, or we do it. It's better if you do it in your own turf, in your own way, because it's your area to handle. But the trouble has been that the rank-and-file interpreters have not been engaged. And the trouble with that is they're all individuals. If you have a chiropractic proposal, you know what group to talk to who represents chiropractors or dietitians or whoever. There is no such group in the rank and file. And so language barriers, they're busy, they're part-time, they have kids. And so I believe you have all their addresses. And so I would suggest that you have a proposal that will include mailing or communicating with each one and let them feedback into an idea pool or something, to so at least there's an understanding that we're going to upscale to some credential or minimum standard or something, but you include them all. And there's still time for that. We still have a couple weeks before the finance bill gets marked out. You actually have money. Not to have the thing solved, but to set a proposal up for an interim plan so that when you bring your budget back next year, in there could be an agreement about how to best oversee and regulate these individuals. And so I'm just, I think that's something you need to do this year, please. Thank you.
Dr. Ellinger.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler. Yes, we have heard those concerns. We had staff certainly were at the meeting last night and have started discussions about how we can best address this issue, which really is a huge issue in our state with increasing need for interpreter service, with high quality that's needed for interpreter service, and our advancing health equity efforts. This all fits in with that. So we will certainly look into that and come up with some plans on how to move forward. So appreciate that.
Okay, Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. And, since we're getting just a bit more into the policy end of this, I just want to say that the department was, first of all, this kind of thing, while the department can think about it and propose it something, and indeed their staff has been working to try to do that and very engaged with this, obviously this is an issue that needs to be resolved in the legislature, and obviously it's an issue that has touches a lot of people in a lot of ways, but the issue isn't new, and it's I think as we have growing diversity in the state, the problem just gets bigger and has been. I don't know why we've gotten to this point where we have such diversity and yet we have basically a standardless system in healthcare for interpreters. And people have tried to fill the gaps in various ways, obviously. And we know that when people have done that, then when you try to get things organized in a way that some people are impacted in maybe unexpected ways. And I think Representative Abler is absolutely right that because of the nature of some of these small practitioners and so on, it is hard to notify people who aren't used to working with the legislature and don't understand the process here and so on. But I do want to say that I think the testimony was pretty compelling on both sides, that this is a huge safety issue. It's a huge healthcare issue. And notwithstanding that it's uncomfortable for a lot of people who are already doing this, the prospect, and I think we heard some of the testimony last night about what can happen when you have an interpreter who is not competent or who doesn't understand the ethics of the situation or who may not be interpreting what the person is actually saying. You can have, the impact of a healthcare visit in those circumstances can be worse than no healthcare visit when the practitioner is not getting or being able to convey information to the patient. So, this is really a pretty urgent issue, and unfortunately, I don't see us being able to resolve it this session. I hope that we can bipartisanly move forward on this, because certainly this is an issue that has been, I really wasn't aware of it until this last interim when I started to get messages relating to exactly what we're talking about here with the department's fee structure and so on. A lot of people were very mad that they're paying this money and nothing's really, from their point of view, nothing has been done with the money, and of course the department only has so much they can do without us. But just to say, I hope that members can resist the urge to make this a partisan issue, and not saying that Representative Abler is doing that, but we had a testifier who was a bit inappropriate in his politicizing in front of the committee here, but this is not a partisan issue. This is an issue of not only the livelihoods of some interpreters, but the safety and health of every member of a community where people don't speak English very well. So this is an issue that minority communities as a whole should be very concerned about, because, the state is paying for people's health care, and we may not be delivering it because we're not delivering a good interpreting services in some cases. So, this is we spent some time on this last night. I'm glad we did. I think we all learned a lot about the parameters of this issue, and I hope that we can really work together to try to resolve it for the benefit of all Minnesotans, not only the ones who are receiving the services or delivering the services, but those whose money is being used to deliver services that need to be safe and effective. So thank you.
Mr.
Okay. We're not here to discuss last night's meeting, but we obviously there is an issue with the interpreters, and we're going to have to address that. Whether we can get that done this year or not, I don't know, but it's your job, Dr. Ellinger. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And unfortunate, I didn't think we was here to talk about the interpreters neither, but I think I need to also share what I think that I was hearing also in reading some of the documents that is to be an interpreter is really a skill, you know, because a lot of the words that we use in the English language has no meaning in so many of the other countries. And so it's a skill to try to formulate to what they're hearing to translate that over to the patient and vice versa, to take that back to someone who only can hear it in English. So it's a skill that has to be, that's needed and has to be crafted. But also, I also heard in one of the testimonies that was written down that one interpreter said that I was being sent out to interpret, and that was really, it's not what my field. I had no expertise there. So I think it's an internal piece also that we need to look at, because you are recruiting interpreters to go out for specific needs, and they don't have the expertise in that need. So I think it's not just an issue with the interpreters themselves, but also the internal placement of interpreters to have the responsibility to fulfill a duty that they have no expertise to do. So I think in both areas, we need to be redefine and look at how the process is really is lining up so that those who are coming out to interpret is an expert or are capable. And I don't know if all the, I would call them barriers that I saw in the document, is the solution to what is needed to have more certified interpreters or experts who can't interpret, but maybe some more training and learning that needs to go along with the expectations of interpreters for sure. But I think there needs to be so much more engagement, and maybe a survey out to all the interpreters can be some way of doing that. I don't know, but they all are all different, and it's not one model that's going to fit all. But I think definitely a bigger pool of input is definitely needed.
Just briefly, Mr. Chair.
So
I mean, I agree with everything everybody said. I didn't politicize this, I don't think. So we have an interim time here, and there's a fund with money in it that's been taken in from these very people, and proposals going about how to properly make sure that they are capable and what standards, etc. There's a 50-50 chance of an administration change coming up on the next budget, and so this could even get lost in the weeds if you're no longer the commissioner, et cetera. And so I think I would just really urge you to come up with a plan to do an interim work, and we'll appropriate some of the money you have sitting in your account to accommodate a good proposal that actually everybody will go, 80% of people go, oh, that's a good proposal. And so you won't get Omar and other people coming up not knowing about it and fearing for their livelihood. And they'll say, no, this is an advancement of the profession. I agree. And I'll get this little credential and I'm good. So anyway, thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm done.
We now have a quorum, so I'll call the meeting to order.
Are we in disorder before?
And Mr. Greenman, continue.
Mr. Chair, I assume I don't have to start over again? Or
no.
Okay, the last proposal, or the fourth proposal we have is a litigation expenses proposal. Governor recommends a one-time $975,000 appropriation in fiscal year 14 for the cost of settling a lawsuit related to the newborn screening program. The governor recommends paying for the settlement cost out of the Health Care Access Fund by making a technical correction to the 2013 Health and Human Services Finance Bill, which returns $1 million per year to the Health Care Access Fund. The net result of the proposal is a $25,000 savings in fiscal year 14 and a $1 million savings every year thereafter. So the proposal includes both the settlement cost and the technical correction. And so that's the net impact. I thought I might provide a little bit of background on the lawsuit to help explain how we got where we are now in this situation. As I think you all recall, the newborn screening program tests about 68,000 infants per year for over 50 types of harmful medical conditions that could result in lifelong medical problems or even death if not detected and treated early. And that program's been in place for a number of years. In 2006, an amendment was added to a government data practices bill during a floor debate that made changes to the treatment of genetic information. The amendment wasn't heard in committee, and during the debate, there was no discussion of how that law would impact the newborn screening program. As a result of some ambiguity in the law, the department was unclear as to how or whether the new law would impact the newborn screening program. In response, the department worked with legislators in 2007 and 2008 on legislation that would clarify the relationship between the two laws. Legislation was passed in 2008, but it was vetoed, and so the law didn't change at that time. In 2009, the department was sued by a group of families alleging that the newborn screening program violated the genetic information law. During the proceedings, the legal proceedings, the department did prevail in district and appellate court levels. However, the state Supreme Court did partially reverse that ruling and sent the case back to the district court level. So at this point, the case had been going on for about 4.5 years. And the department had the choice of either settling with the plaintiffs or going to trial in early 2014. In determining how to proceed from there, the department carefully weighed the potential financial and legal risks of going to trial against the risk associated with selling the lawsuit against going to trial. The department has already spent $550,000 in legal fees to the Attorney General's office and nearly $140,000 for the in-house department legal staff related to the lawsuit. In addition to the legal costs, the public health lab has spent literally thousands of hours responding to requests for information and motions related to the case. Ultimately, to avoid the considerable cost of going to trial, the department elected to settle the lawsuit with the plaintiffs. The settlement requires the department to pay a portion of the legal fees for the plaintiffs, but does not include any damages to the plaintiffs. In 2013, there was bipartisan legislation that was passed that does address the ambiguity in the law and clears it up, that the statute that resulted in the lawsuit. So that's been cleared up.
Okay, any questions?
Mr. Chair, I'm just trying to understand the fiscal note here.
Representative Abler.
So how much, well, I just got a couple, how much are we going to give the plaintiffs then?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, the settlement requires the department to pay $975,000 in, which is a portion of the plaintiff's legal fees. I think it's roughly half, maybe a little bit more than half of the plaintiff's legal fees. Those go to the attorneys for the plaintiffs.
And Mr. Chair, just then to the fiscal note, looks like there's $1 million a year for 3 years, and so you combine technical correction with the legal fees on your fiscal note?
That's the language in the governor's proposal. Yes,
but so it's only $1 million. That's about $1 million out of the healthcare access fund that you want us to pay.
Yeah, Mr. Greenman.
Mr. Chair, the $975,000 would come out of the healthcare access fund. At the same time, this proposal corrects. There was a technical error last year in the omnibus finance bill that will actually provide savings to the healthcare access fund of $1 million a year. So the one-time appropriation for the settlement is offset by the savings to the healthcare access fund. So the net impact to the healthcare access fund is a savings of $25,000 in fiscal year 14, and $1 million savings every year thereafter.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, that your decision is you want to pay for a healthcare access fund, which is actually meant to be for people who are sick or some other way. So, that's fun being chair, isn't it, Mr. Chair?
Well, I'm I understand what the issue is. And, I'm not sure it should come out of the Health Care Access Fund.
Yeah, thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Dean was next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. The along the same lines of Representative Abler, wondering what the decision would be if we did not utilize, if we could have a technical correction without this lawsuit money being taken out of the Health Care Access Fund. I would assume that we would still save $1 million a year or more in the Health Care Access Fund. Is that correct?
Mr. Freeman.
Representative Dean, Mr. Chair, that's correct.
And Mr. Chair and Commissioner, so those two things don't have to anything to do with one another. You needed $1 million to pay for this lawsuit. You chose to use it from the governor's choice was to use it from the Health Care Access Fund, and that's what's being reflected on this. And I think that one more question. I believe I was just looking at the January report from the Health Care Access Fund, and it looks like we had a $325 million shift from the Health Care Access Fund in fiscal year 13 for a one-time shift to pay for this year's budget in terms of our health care costs. Is that scheduled to continue on? And if so, when will the Health Care Access Fund reach zero in its balance?
Mr. Greenman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, I'd probably feel more comfortable to have MMB answer that question. That's their forecast account. I'm not sure exactly when that would happen.
Thank you.
Representative Quam, we have to move on, though. So.
Right. What was related to that, I was wondering what the current balance of the Health Care Access Fund and what is the projected balance for next year?
I don't know if Mr. Greenman knows, but... Mr. Berg, I think, knows. We'll give you a rough answer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Quam, the February forecast numbers for the Health Care Access Fund show a balance of $26,778,000 at the end of fiscal 14 and $37,791,000 at the end of 15. The fund is projected to go into deficit in fiscal 16.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that when we use or divert funds out of an account, we ought to actually know what's in it so we know the proportion that we're spending.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you for your testimony, Dr. Ellinger and Mr. Greenman. And we'll now go to the Department of Human Services. But we're going to have other people testify this evening. Wait a minute. Agreement. Did we have, did you discuss the technical corrections?
Sorry, Mr. Chair, we had one more very technical correction. These were to the 2013 Omnibus Finance Bill. They were, I apologize, I forgot to mention it. We've been working with fiscal staff on this. There were a couple things in the bill that just needed to be corrected. There was a provision in the 13 bill that appropriated money out of the special revenue fund, which is a special fund that doesn't actually get appropriated out of the bill, so we had to remove that. And also there was some language passed last year that for the infectious disease lab at the department, we were proposing and legislation was passed to basically end the current fee program for the lab and to stop the appropriation from the state government special revenue fund. We were going to stop both of those July 1 of 2014. What ended up happening is we're still collecting the fees till July 1 of 14. However, inadvertently the appropriation was ended 1 year early, so this would just provide us with the funding to cover that matches the fee revenue that we're collecting.
That's okay. It. Thank you very much.
Sorry about that.
Questions? No. Okay. So let's move on then to Human Services. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Lucinda Jessen, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Services. And with me here today is our new CFO, Alex Kutsa, who I know you all will get to know. So I wanted to make sure I introduced her to all of you. I believe you have a copy of a PowerPoint. I was just going to kind of use this to walk through, if that's acceptable to you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, but...
Okay. Well, our first page just lets you know how the governor's proposed budget for the Department of Human Services contributes to our overall goals to build strong and stable families and communities by increasing the number of people who are served in the community, by making our goal of making sure that all Minnesotans have optimal health, by looking at improvements in our mental health services, ensuring federal compliance, some savings and efficiency ideas, and finally, to making sure that people in Minnesota are safe. You know, I would start out by saying, Mr. Chair, members, as I think you know, the governor's supplemental budget is for the department, and I think across the board, was really focused on what he viewed essential. And what was really critical to be able to continue to fulfill the obligations that the legislature and in some situations the courts have placed upon us. So I will be the first to say there are a lot of good policy, interesting policy ideas that are out there, budget ideas, but this is really limited to what we saw as the essential items. And I think first on that list certainly is an increase, a 4% rate increase to home and community-based providers. You know, I think many of you all are very, all of you, I think, are well aware that over the last 10 years, our home and community-based providers have generally seen a greater reduction in rates than other long-term care providers, making it incredibly difficult for these providers to maintain staff, and that has real consequences to the people that we serve. So this proposal increases the payment rates by 4% effective July 1. That, together with the 1% increase, which was passed last year by the legislature, would equal a 5% increase. 75% of this rate increase under the governor's proposal must go towards worker pay and benefits. And there's a process that will be set out about if there are concerns about that employees may about that distribution, that employees may contact the department, and we will look into that. 3% of this rate increases across the board, and 1% is dedicated to quality. Having said that, we're assuming that 1% quality increase is going to go into every provider's rates starting on July 1st as well. I think that having a quality component and trying to, as we give increased payment, trying to tie that to better outcomes for people for quality improvement is something that's been very important, I think, to certainly to me, to the governor, and I know to many of you as well. That is harder to do for home and community-based providers because of the variety of providers in this area than it is, and because we don't have as established measures here that we do in nursing homes, for example. But what we're trying to do here is at least get everyone started down that path. So the quality to continue to receive that 1%, what a provider needs to do is to commit to engaging in a quality improvement project. It's a project that that provider chooses. They tell us what it is, and the department is given kind of three very broad areas you know, that they can choose from, but it is really driven by the provider. So I just wanted to provide that explanation. Happy to answer questions either as we go along, Mr. Chair, or at the end, whatever.
Okay. Any questions on this one? I don't see any, so continue.
Okay. We'll turn to the next page. First, let me talk about our home and community-based service performance-based incentive payment program, so a PIP. And we just, this is really a technical correction here, Mr. Chair, members. And let me just note that this, the corresponds with page 5 in the handout that you all received as far as the governor's supplemental budget recommendations. As most of you all know, that last year the legislature passed a program, starting kind of a PIP program for home and community-based providers. This is something we've done for nursing home providers for many years. And what we've seen, actually, there was an article in Health Affairs, which I know you're a loyal reader of, Mr. Chair, just last fall, which talked about how our PIP program for nursing homes has really been a national model, has resulted in really increased quality for those providers who participate. And so we want to have that same program for our home and community-based provider. But we neglected to include a few of those providers in the language last year. We included the appropriations, but we didn't include personal care attendants, for example. And I think there was couple of personal care attendants, private duty nursing, and home health care aides. So we want to add them to the list of providers who are eligible to receive this funds from this program for quality improvement. It also changes the quality add-on from a fixed amount to a forecasted appropriation, which we think will make it easier for us to distribute these dollars going forward. It would be the fixed dollar amount to an appropriation-based amount, but not to exceed 1%. And it also corrects a mistake last year where there was a double appropriation for our essential community supports program, so that's why there is a small savings.
Okay. Representative Quam, did you have a question?
Just a clarification of who would be, would this be worked through a group or association for the additional, or is it just each individual has a plan? Yeah. You know, what form do these plans for these additional people being added come in?
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, the way the department runs, does these programs is we put out an RFP. It's like an RFP process. We put out a request for proposals. Sometimes it's individual providers, but so often what we'll see is providers will come together to make a proposal for these dollars. So it's a competitive process. And if you have a lot more detailed questions, I certainly have a lot of people here who can answer those for you.
Okay. Please proceed.
Next, at the bottom of page 4, it refers to changes in our Community First Services and Supports Program. These are mostly technical changes, but a few policy ones. As you all recall, last year the legislature passed our Community First CFSS, Community First Program, which is really a redesign of our existing personal care assistance program. This was passed last year, but this whole idea was part of our Reform 2020 initiative, which had its genesis back in 2011. And I think overall, as you all recall, this is a program really to make this program more accessible, more consumer-directed, to provide some additional benefits so people can get those without having to go to our more expensive waiver program to wait in line for those. So it is really, I think, going to be a very good program. The legislation also required us to meet with stakeholders and to work on program integrity. You know, we want to serve more people in the community. As we do that, we also know that there sometimes are more program integrity challenges. So this proposal will include some of the recommendations which were in our November report to the legislature that are related to program integrity. And it also provides the department the authority to establish a payment rate methodology for these consultation and financial services. So CMS has been very clear that as we're asking participants in this program to make a choice, do you want to really, as we hope many will, take more responsibility and be in a consumer-directed program where you're directing your own dollars, you know, hiring who you want to, or do you want to go to a traditional agency model? That there be kind of an independent consultant available so that people are well-informed as they make those choices. And for people who choose that consumer model to make sure that they have kind of a financial assistance, expertise, available as well. So this really just gives us the ability to establish payment methodologies. It's not for those services, which will be available to all individuals who are in this program. Another policy change that this involves is allowing parents of minors and spouses to be paid as direct support workers. you know, this is something that we do in our current consumer-directed program, but was not clear about whether it could be done in the new Community First model. And so it's consistent with our other self-directed programs, and we think is very appropriate. Finally, there's some language changes that you all will see to reflect some, you know, service design and policy areas, such as establishing some billing requirements, limiting the number of hours that a caregiver can bill and be paid for, which is kind of a program integrity issue in part. And it really makes those, though it's, these aren't new limits, these really make sure these limits are, these hourly limits are consistent with our current PCA program. And it clarifies some financial liability matters as well, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner, the current thing we passed, if I understand it, has a restrictive definition of dependency, which favors those with physical disabilities more than it favors mental illness, brain injuries, developmental disabilities. And we're asking for the feds to approve this, and my understanding is that the feds don't like this restrictive definition. And do you have any comment on that?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think we're in negotiations with the federal government over that. I mean, we would like to be able to have a broader, you know, I mean, while we think that the proposal, once passed by the legislature, and we're now negotiating with the feds, is lawful, is appropriate. Certainly, a broader definition of dependency, you know, is something that resonates with me. That has price tag, you know, and I think that's something that certainly is that we didn't deem as being kind of essential in this non-budget year, but certainly as a matter of policy and kind of. But a priority setting going forward is certainly something very worthy of further discussion.
Well, just for the members, if the feds don't approve it, we lose a lot of federal money that we had planned on getting. Representative Laughlin.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Chair and Commissioner. You know, I just wanted to follow up on that because I think that we actually assume that we'd have approval from the federal government for the enhanced federal participation as of, I think, even this spring. And, you know, I really think we need to better understand what the tension points are and whether or not we ought to move forward on some policy changes to order to get that approved so we can get moving forward on these reforms. I think it's been disruptive to our service system and the people whose lives are impacted to, you know, continue to have this sort of major changes kind of hung out there, and then it's not clear if the funding's coming and when it's going to happen. And, you know, if we can get some deeper briefing on, you know, what the status is of that and the trade-offs and how we can assist in accelerating that, that would be helpful.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, we're happy to do that. I mean, I do not want to paint this as a bleak picture. I think we're having very good negotiations with the federal government. You know, they're asking questions about a number of things. That's very typical, but I would be very happy to provide more information and do that briefing.
Thank you. Please continue.
On the next page, you'll see a budget request related to the Jensen settlement, and there's more information on page 9 in your packet as well. And I think many of you all will recall the Jensen lawsuit came out of a situation at our Cambridge facility, our Mito facility, and this was also highlighted in the Ombudsman report back in 2008, where at that facility, inappropriate uses of restraints and seclusion, especially restraints, including things, you know, as egregious as metal handcuffs, were being used on that population of, and this is a population of individuals with often with developmental disabilities, but who had, you know, often aggressive symptoms. We settled that lawsuit in 2011. It was a class action lawsuit, and so it was a class settlement. There was ongoing court oversight, and one of the obligations that we was part of the judge's order in December 2011 was that we would close the Mito facility and provide for appropriate follow-up. Just last month, there was kind of an order that had kind of for the next steps a comprehensive plan of action. And that plan of action called for, I think, more oversight, more dollars, frankly, than we had anticipated, and that's why this budget item is here. That plan, which is, you know, put forth by the special master, to be adopted by the federal judge, requires us basically to have therapeutic follow-up for all of these class members after they left MEDO. So all those 390 individuals that are part of the class that were at MEDO when these things happened, we need to provide professional staff to follow them, make sure that they have a safety network, that we do a lot to coordinate their care, to avoid reinstitutionalization and additional transfers, and to really make sure that these individuals are in the most integrated setting. Now, these are functions, frankly, that in normal circumstances would be handled by the counties. But I think the judge here, and I think this is very appropriate, said that given this lawsuit and the settlement and what happened to these clients, that he wanted the Department of Human Services to have the staff that we would provide this follow-up services for these 390 individuals. So you will see FTE requests to do that going forward. The other part of the Jensen settlement, which there was more concrete direction from the court on, was about around the modernization of Rule 40. This is a rule that's kind of the old terminology for it, but it's what most of us know about. And it governs the use of aversive and deprivation procedures in licensed facilities that serve people with developmental disabilities. So as part of that modernization, which is really kind of trying to kind of move to a much better and different way of serving these folks, including more positive social and behavioral supports, more prohibitions on the use of restraints and seclusion. As part of that, you can't just say, okay, we've changed the rule, and expect that to really change practice without a lot of support. And that's the other part of this budget request, is for that support. Support for training for all these providers in these new rules, but also support for technical expertise, because I think there's a group particularly of about 300 or 400 individuals who will be very hard to make this transition. You know, someone who's perhaps worn a helmet, you know, all, you know, for much of their adult life. You know, maybe that, what are other options? So we really need not just training, but I think outside technical expertise to help us adapt to what is going to be a better rule, but a big change for many of our providers. I would say also one item that's not in our request, but I think will give you an idea of why we're making this special request, because we absorbed a lot of the initial lawsuit things just within our budget, and that was just yesterday we found out that the special master is anticipating that just to oversee the new things that I talked about, that he will be billing us about $315,000. You know, so we're not including that, but I think that just goes to there's more than we expected, but it is very important work, and that's what is beneath the governor's budget request for the Jensen settlement.
Commissioner, the middle point, direct care staff to follow with clients as they move into community-based placements. That means they're moving out of a state-operated facility into a non-state-operated facility, and how long is the direct care staff going to be in this other facility? Are they just training the people that work in that facility what this particular individual needs?
Mr. Chair, it's a couple of things. And some of these people are moving into a state-operated facility, but just one that's in a much more community setting. So out of an institution, really, into the community. So there will be part of these will be training the direct care staff, whether it's state-operated staff or private providers. But a lot of this is much more the care coordination roles that the counties would typically play. Then this does not pay for someone to serve, you know, the day-to-day workers at a provider. And if you have more, I'm sorry. If there are more detailed questions, Mr. Chair, Deputy Commissioner Ann Berry, who's very familiar with this, is here and happy to answer them too.
I'll talk to her after the meeting.
Yeah, thanks. And I'll just, this is actually, we could spend the whole hour on this, but I won't. I just have a question or two. So there's 390 people that have been moved out. Can you just tell me, like, you mentioned that they've gone different places. Like, how many are in the community, and what kind of settings are they in, and how many are in an institution?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, it really, 390 involve the class members who were at MEDO during this period of time when these inappropriate actions, restraints were being used. But what we have seen, so those 390 have really moved into very different settings depending upon, you know, their situation, because it's very individualized, which is why we take, for this is a complex population and it takes a lot of work to get them in the right settings. We only have, I think we're down to like only five who are being served at the still in Cambridge, and we have plans in place for moving those just in the next few months mostly. So some of them go into, our adult foster care or group homes, but ones with, specialized settings often. We're actually building a couple of, not just building, but leasing, a couple of additional homes specifically for this population, which is a challenging population for most providers to serve.
Well, I don't have time to get very deep into it, but I'm just amazed that some of these actually are being allowed in cities and towns, and there's not a big deal about that, so I'll just leave that for now. And just one other question. Just a comment. When judges impose things on states about things that they feel are inappropriate, it can be very expensive. There might be another case about that coming along, Madam Commissioner. And then finally, the $1.4 million that we're going to spend on follow-up, is that a burden the counties are being relieved of, so they should be happy about this?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, that would be my view.
Thank you.
We have three more people, and remember, we're supposed to be done here at 11:30. Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and I was going to kind of make a similar point as Representative Abler on the court order. I was just going to ask the commissioner, you mentioned the bill for the special master, and I was just going to ask you, so what happens if the court orders and the legislature says, we don't want to pay that bill, and, just out of curiosity, what would happen in that case?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, are you asking me as Commissioner of Human Services or as a lawyer?
Well, Mr. Chair and Commissioner, maybe you could give us both answers.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I think that there's certainly some level of things that we, try to absorb before within our budget before coming to the legislature. So we didn't come, we settled the Jensen lawsuit, and we absorbed that. We did not come and ask for that. But it's like you can only, and that was a significant settlement up front, but you can only absorb so much. And when we can't absorb that, then we need to come to the legislature. And I think that really kind of gets back to that whole balance of power equation that, courts were looking at, back to, Mulberry versus Madison. So I find it best as both a commissioner and a lawyer to follow court directives and orders.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, and I won't
Representative Liebling, who knows more about court ordering on certain issues.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Though she is a lawyer, but she on this particular issue, she's devoted a lot of time on the EPSA.
Of course, so is the commissioner. We've worked together a lot on this, and I, thank you for that very lawyerly answer, going back to Marbury versus Madison, and I just think it's instructive for all of us on this Jensen issue to be mindful that if we don't do our own work, the court is going to do it for us, and we are going to have a bill that we don't have any control over, and we're just going to have to pay it. So I think Representative Abler's point, was similar. Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. I think this is a good example of how we do have real legal risks when we aren't doing our best for the people we're responsible for overseeing the care of. And I believe it was actually this Jensen case that led to the order for development of an Olmstead plan, which is based on a U.S. Supreme Court case named Olmstead. It's not about Representative Liebling's home county. But my understanding, I'm really kind of surprised that we are not then seeing a budget that helps us accelerate our implementation of that plan so that we can avoid these kind of legal challenges and costs. And perhaps you can address why we're not seeing that, because I know a lot of that is going to be require transition costs, and I think we need to evaluate, first of all, doing the right thing for people, but also protecting ourselves against this kind of future legal liability.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, I wholeheartedly agree with you about the importance of the Olmstead Plan. We did settle the Jensen case, but we settled it looking at the potential liability. And because it was a class action, there was this continued court oversight. And as part of that, we agreed to develop and were directed to develop an Olmstead Plan. While this budget in the Department of Human Services this year doesn't include a specific Olmstead component, one, we are doing a lot of that work in the department, and we're looking at what we should be in a budget year bringing to the legislature next year to do more. I would say that there is a budget item in the governor's budget for kind of that centralized implementation office called for by the Olmstead Plan. I believe that's actually going through deeds committees since they're housing part of that. But that is kind of a, so that there is a request in the governor's budget for $500,000 for the fiscal year 15, and then I think kind of $2 million a year in 16 and 17.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you. I just think that's something that we on the Finance Committee really have to stay on top of, because I think the liabilities are significant and the obligations are as well.
Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for the Commissioner. So during the interim, we met up in Cambridge. We had an opportunity to look at the facility there and some potential future uses. And I know there was some community concern about that and certainly how that was rolled out and introduced to that area. And so I'm just wondering where the administration stands on the future of that facility moving forward, and if we can provide assurances back to the folks in Cambridge that the idea of relocating folks out of the MSOP to Cambridge, if we can continue to absolve them of that fear and kind of reassure them that that's not in your plans moving forward.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zerwas, I think that the governor has made it very clear that at his direction, that there will not be people moved from the sex offender program into the Cambridge facility, the old Cambridge hospital. You know, as far we cannot control, obviously, what courts direct. You know, I would note also that as far as our future plans for that facility, that is something we're looking at now. But right now, we still do have five clients who are still there. So we need to make sure that they are moved out of that facility. And then I think it's a, you know, and we're looking at other options for a host of them for what we should be doing with Cambridge after that.
Okay. Members, we are, we have about 20 minutes left. Might run a little over, but so just remember that. Commissioner, number five.
Number five, North Star Care for Children. These are really technical, a small fiscal change to the North Star for Children legislation that was passed last year. That was legislation, as you all recall, that consolidated and simplified administration of three of our child welfare programs, and really helped, you know, took steps to reduce the number of children in out-of-home care by, you know, equalizing really our adoption assistance and foster care payments for children over six. But there are some things we need to do to bring this into federal compliance, add some federally required background study requirements, add kind of, there's some federal compliance pieces that are very small around eligibility for kinship assistance, and this clarifies eligibility to be inclusive of tribal and county agency practices. If no questions, I will move on.
Any questions? I don't see any. So, Commissioner.
The next proposal, while Mr. Chair, members, while budget neutral, is very complex, especially when it comes to hospital rebasing. I think that many of you all know that we're still, the last rebasing was in 2007, and we're really using kind of numbers from 2002 to pay our hospitals. But effective next October, CMS is requiring that we and the hospitals use what's called ICD-10. So a new way, a set of procedure and diagnosis codes for paying hospitals, for all inpatient hospital claims. Many of you have been aware of this because we've been trying to upgrade our systems for a while to deal with what we knew was coming. So we have to update our payment systems. And as part of that update, so that's a requirement. And to do that, we really need to go to using what they call a grouper, a new grouper. So that grouper is basically a structure that's going to puts different claims together for the basis of payments. And right now, the grouper that we use is basically the Medicare grouper. And the Medicare grouper doesn't fit very well for the Medicaid population because, as you can imagine, you know, in Medicaid, like, we pay for 40% of all births, you know, in the state of Minnesota. Well, there's not a lot of – our Medicare grouper doesn't differentiate for, like, high-risk pregnancies or neonatal care. And what we really want to use this to do is to say, okay, what's the patient mix at this hospital, and to pay them appropriately for their patient mix, but yet we have a grouper that is not the best for our Medicaid population. So this would update our grouper, and as part, you know, having a new grouper would then rebase our payments. I think I will be the first to say that this is complicated, and there are a lot of moving parts. Because until we have the new grouper and the rebasement, we can't tell you, you know, exactly how that's going to play out for each individual hospital, you know. But we are working very closely with the hospital association, you know, on what's the best grouper, what's the best methodology, and we also, I think at the end of the day, our strong hope is that this is going to improve the relationship between what we pay hospitals, and this is in our fee-for-service system, you know, and the patient risk and severity of our Medicaid population. So we really want to tie payments much closer to who are the patients that they're serving, how expensive and how risky are that. And we're just using incredibly outdated numbers, which, you know, we could say, well, this isn't why is this essential? Well, it's essential because we have to change, or, frankly, we're just not going to be able to make payments that meets federal requirements starting in October. So I know that this will be a matter of ongoing discussion, and happy to do that now, later, as the chair would prefer. I would also note a couple of other small things as part of this. This proposal, the department is required under federal law to collect Medicare cost report data from hospitals that receive our DSH payments, our disproportionate share payments, so that enables us to make that, put that requirement into place. And it also makes a change to settle up processes for our federally qualified health centers and rural health centers. Basically saying, look, what we want to have, rather than being able to go back for, you know, 8 or 9 years to kind of look at differences, which just sometimes happens now, this proposes to, like, once a year, you know, send them kind of a proposal about, this is where we see the payments to you come to this particular, you know, FQHC, for an example. And then they have a chance for the last 2 years. So basically, be able to go back 2 years. They have a chance to dispute that and work with us. If we can't reach a resolution, then to go to binding arbitration. But I think that trying to have these ongoing adjustments done in a more timely way and putting in a mechanism for dispute resolution would really be helpful. But this is, I would say, something we are having ongoing discussions with the federally qualified health centers and rural health centers about. I think we're even meeting tomorrow about this proposal.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to take a lot of time, but, Commissioner, I just was puzzled by your use of the term grouper, which nobody here seemed to know what it was, but I think I found it in the document on page 15, and I guess that's the DRG grouping factor. Is that what you're calling a grouper?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, yes, that is. And there is more detail. Thank you for pointing that out on page 15 of our handout about the rebasing. And I'm sorry I didn't characterize it very clearly in my testimony.
Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I did hear you also say that we pay for 40% of all births. Is that correct? You did say that?
And Mr. Chair, Representative Fritz, yes, in medical assistance, MA pays for about 40% of all births in Minnesota.
And what is the birth rate? Do you have any figures? Or can we get those figures?
Mr. Chair, Representative, happy to get you those figures. Okay. I don't remember right now.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. Whenever the words cost neutral and rebasing come together, it strikes fear in the hearts of those who have been caught in, even just as recently as last year, great panic among the part of our providers. about who the big winners are and who the big losers are? And can you, do you have any preliminary information about kind of what the ranges we could expect? And will this actually be implemented this October? When will we have the data available?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, I understand the real challenge of having any rebasing that is budget neutral. One of the things we would like to do, and have been in discussions with the Hospital Association about this as well, is at the same about the same time this goes into effect, also be able to, because we think they're very close to being able to, hospitals have earned kind of the 5% rate cut payback. As many of you all recall, in 2011, we cut fee-for-service rates to hospitals by 10%, but said hospitals can earn back half of that rate cut if they kind of reduce their readmissions by a certain amount. And we're looking at these readmissions by region. We are looking at that data, and, you know, we think, and we need to finalize it still, but we think that hospitals have come extraordinarily close to earning back, if not all, almost all of that 5% rate cut. We think actually having that kind of go back to hospitals at the same time will really at least help, you know, for those who may perhaps are lose money on the rebasing, you know, see some additional funding. So that is one of the things we're looking at doing, trying to kind of mitigate against this. And I could certainly ask Assistant Commissioner Nathan Morocco to come up and talk a little bit more about in detail about exactly when we'll have this. We've the information on how it would impact individual hospitals. We've hired a consultant who's nationally recognized to help us work through this. I think I mentioned this just because we will not have that data before you have to vote on this. And I just want to be, you know, upfront about that.
The Hospital Association is going to testify this evening on this particular item, so
we'll hear from them. Commissioner, given the time, I think we can probably get a memo or a follow-up on that. That'd be great.
Okay. Please proceed.
Next, turning to page 7 in your packet, let me talk about our care facilities, and this relates to page 17 in your packet, which we want more detail. Our care facilities, Community Addiction Recovery Enterprises, are as a part of our state-operated services that primarily serves individuals who are committed to the commissioner and have very complex clinical dependency needs and can't be served really by other providers. These are residential facilities. These are some of our very most complex patients. And frankly, the rate structure does not, the current rate structure under our consolidated chemical dependency fund pays providers the same and doesn't take into account kind of the difficult needs of these most complex patients. So we have a deficit. The governor is proposing a one-time appropriation of $2 million to take care of that deficit in this fiscal year. But from my perspective, this is a one-time should be one-time money. We at the department are looking at two different things to address this because this isn't an enterprise fund, you know, and so we need to either make these facilities cash flow or, you know, we need to look at whether or not we should be in this business. We're taking a different look, a new look at the rate methodology as part of what we'll be doing the next year. And we're also pursuing a change in our state plan amendment so that we could be allowed to have a different rate for a state-operated provider who serves these most complex patients. It really is the safety net for other providers.
I don't see any questions, so Commissioner, move on to number 8.
Number 8 is a rate adjustment, Mr. Chair, members, for Andrew residents. As many of you all know, Andrew residents, which is in Hennepin County, serves over 200 people with serious and mental illness who also meet a nursing home level of care. It's the only facility of its nursing home level of care. It's the only facility of its kind in Minnesota. And this proposal really codifies our current payments to Andrew's residents. So this is not an increase for them. But what we did a review of the current rates we're paying across many programs, and during that review we found that the amount we're paying to Andrew's residents doesn't align with the requirements in statute. So our current per diem for to pay to Andrew is, depending on the patient, obviously, between $130 and $163, and the per diem, according to statute, is $113 to $143. But we believe unless we're able to bring our authority to pay this in line with what the payments are, that we'll not be able to continue to serve these high-needs patients at Andrews.
Okay, let's move on then.
Mr. Chair, number 9 is on the coordination of benefits registry. This provides, this is a savings, but it provides us funding to contract with a nonprofit, the Council of Affordable Quality Healthcare, to basically automate our coordination of benefits programs. Medicaid should only be the payer of last resort, and this is really going to be able to easily check for us to see if there's another payer that we ought to be that ought to be paying for this. So you'll see that while there are costs, there are more. It's really ultimately savings because we believe it will save us money in the long term and in the short term, actually.
Okay. Move on to number 10.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Number 10 relates to the governor's proposal for a salary supplement for employees on our state-operated services and our sex offender treatment program. I think all of you are well aware that these staff provide direct care to some of the most complex clients, many who present high public safety risks. And we have absorbed over the last, fiscal year 13 and 14, let's take state-operated services first. We've absorbed over $5.6 million related to the 1% and 3% raises that were in the that went into effect through the contracts. But we, frankly, cannot absorb the upcoming increases, you know, without having to have layoffs or closure of facilities. So if the funding is not provided, state-operated services would have to lay off about 118 FTEs in our mental health services and 85 FTEs in our forensic, mostly security, hospital. And, you know, we're not asking for a salary supplement for our central services, our central office. We can at least, while not easily, but we can handle, you can leave positions open for a longer period of time, not fill things. But here, 80% of our costs, or more than 80% in these direct indirect care, are salaried positions. And, you know, I frankly have just authorized additional FTEs, kind of trying to move people within the system because of the needs at Security Hospital. We need more staff there. Did the same last year during a kind of a crisis at Anoka. So this would really, having to lay off these employees would be going very much in the wrong direction, and I think present real risk to our clients and in some situations to the public. Similarly, at MSOP, they've absorbed nearly $3 million in salary increases in 2013 and 2014. And if this proposal isn't funded, they're going to have to lay off 15 security or clinic staff. This is at a facility where we've been told by the legislative auditor we need more clinical services and staff. So once again, I think this would be a real risk. And that's why the governor has proposed a salary supplement for our direct care side, much as he has in the corrections area as well, kind of the same philosophy.
Please continue.
And finally, Mr. Chair, the governor proposes a one-time appropriation of $3 million in this fiscal year for the funding to comply with the Karsten's court order. As I think many members are well aware, the federal court, in listening to kind of arguments about whether the sex offender treatment program was constitutional or not, did not immediately rule on that, though there's a lot of rhetoric in the opinion. But he did order evaluations of all 700 of our clients. And he's to start with three different groups, kind of those who are in more of our assisted living group, individuals with intellectual disabilities, and kind of the young adults program. And so this is very much just funding for those expert reviews. These are experts that are not chosen by us. They're chosen by the court. And, you know, based upon the fiscal note we actually did last year where we were proposing biennial reviews, plus the fact that these experts by the court are more costly than those we are planning on contracting with when we're anticipating doing this ourselves, this is kind of our budget estimate. for what this is going to cost just for these reviews.
Please continue. Is that it?
And Mr. Chair, that is that ends my presentation.
Mr. Chair, questions? Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I didn't want to burn the time if we didn't have any, but since we have just a couple of minutes, I wanted to ask about this Andrew Residence. Is that a nonprofit facility, a state-owned facility, or I've never heard of that facility before, Commissioner. So that's one question I have. And the second one was just a real quick one maybe you can answer. So when we do this, and I agree that we need to make sure that we keep the staff and increase the do the salary supplement for the state operated services and MSOP, but I assume you'll have to recalculate the per diem after you do that, and I'll be interested to see where it ends up.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, point taken, you're right. We will have to do that, get that information to you.
That facility has, it says the 200 clients or people that are living there. Is that 200 over a year, or is that 200 beds that they have?
Mr. Chair, I believe it is 200 at one time, not over a year, but maybe I could ask Deputy Commissioner Ann Berry. Do you have more information? That's the number of beds they have.
That's a huge facility.
Yeah, Mr.
Chair.
Yeah, and is that, I don't think I heard the answer, or maybe if you need somebody, is that a nonprofit? Is it a for-profit? Is it a state-owned facility? Who are those folks?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I believe it's a nonprofit, but I will get back to you on that. It is not a state facility. It is in Hennepin County. It is, for an example, where a number of people being discharged, for example, provisionally discharged from Security Hospital, who are Hennepin County residents, end up there. And you know, some other of our most complex people with most complex needs.
Representative Abler.
Thanks, and I just want to at least raise this topic for future discussion. Our healthcare access fund is noted on the spreadsheet here, and by 2017 we're short $647 million, and I was looking through again all your proposals. I don't see any proposal to talk about that. And you know, we were supposed to balance out 4 years, and this was kind of unforeseen. There's some little tweak maybe coming from the feds, but I do know we overbuilt our basic health plan, and it's better than platinum. And when I was in the conference committee last year, I kept asking what choices are we making, and nobody had any advice about that. But here we have a deficit of two-thirds of $1 billion. And do you have a comment about that and what the governor plans to do?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler. the health care access fund is in balance for this biennium. There certainly is a challenge in the next biennium. From my perspective, we need to quantify that challenge before we try and solve for it. So right now, there are a number of unknowns. The basic reason we have an unexpected deficit in the healthcare access fund is because our Minnesota Care program would be funded by kind of this basic health plan option, where the federal government says that we can get 95% of what they would otherwise pay in exchange to serve this population of single adults. But that 95% is a lot less than we anticipated because of the good news that we have the lowest rates in the country. So when we made the budget projections on what that would be, we assumed that our rates would be about similar to what Wisconsin's are now. Well, the good news is they're a lot lower, but that means we get less money from the federal government. But how much less and what population is going to be served by Minnesota Care going forward, there are a lot of unknowns around that when we put this together. For example, there's a payment rule that the federal government adopted. They came out with a proposed rule in December, which would have caught, you know, the impact on Minnesota would have been even $200 million less about than we had anticipated. On the other hand, we worked hard, and I really so appreciate many of you who weighed in, including you, Representative Abler, you know, and you know, certainly Representative Huntley, Representative Liebling, I believe, others, who weighed in and said to the federal government, this is unfair to Minnesota. And so they moved a lot on matters that are critical to us. So I anticipate that deficit going down, not being solved by what the federal government did, but that it will have, those are significant dollars, and we're trying to figure out exactly what those will look like. But another thing that we certainly don't know is what's the population, that's going to be in this Minnesota Care program. And there are a lot of unknowns just as we start in this whole new world of healthcare with the changes that went into effect in January 2014. A lot of good changes, but unknowns. For example, and cut me off if I'm going too long, Representative Huntley, Chair Huntley. But for example, in where we are today in enrollment, enrollment is through Minsure is over our projections for Medicaid. So we have even more people signing up for Medicaid than we anticipated. But we are under projections for Minnesota Care. So how that shakes out and how many people end up in Minnesota Care versus our Medicaid program is another major factor. So I, from my perspective, Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that we need to have a better handle on how big the problem is before we solve for it. But that doesn't, that I certainly will be one of the first to acknowledge that solving that problem is going to be, is a very important priority.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Commissioner Jessen, I was looking through the change documents for the Department of Human Services and looking, kind of looking from front to back and waited till the end. There's no line item that indicates any change for DHS for Minsure. Yet I notice that there's dozens of employees on loan, and I'm wondering what the interchange between the two is and how that might be reflected in the change documents, or if it is reflected in the change documents at all. And then secondarily, we are going to be receiving a report from Minsure, I believe, this week, according to the what I read in the Star Tribune, that you said that you have concerns over. I'm wondering if the governor has reviewed that and if he stands behind that budget and that document, and then if you might be coming before this committee with that report in the near future with Commissioner Leitz, if that is on your docket.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean. First of all, as far as the employees on loan, we have interagency agreements between DHS and Minsure, so that when there is an employee of ours that's working at Minsure, either Minsure is paying for it, or there's an interagency agreement, so that we are doing some work, just especially kind of these manual processes that we're having to use. The good news is most people are making it through the system now, but for those who aren't, we're having to do more like around paper applications that we're processing at DHS and a number of things. But where we're doing that for cases that are QHP cases as opposed to public program cases, we are in this interagency agreement kind of basically billing Minsure for those. So that's why, you know, so that's, I think, part of the answer to your question. You know, I think that as far as the budget, there was a preliminary budget for 2015 that the legislature said we needed to report to the give to the legislature by March 15th. And just yesterday, there was that preliminary budget was adopted by the board. You know, that budget is, preliminary is a kind word. I mean, we have more, by the time we actually have to submit a budget for 2015, we'll have more experience between now and then than we do just in the past few months. So this is a very preliminary budget. You will be receiving it. I don't know the board, because Minsure is governed by the board of directors, and the board just saw the first preliminary budget Tuesday night. We adopted it yesterday. I don't know if the governor has has seen that, but given just the preliminary nature of it and the fact that Minsure is governed by the board, I'm not sure he would need to, but I have been obviously trying to keep the governor up to date on all of this. I would say my concerns, which I expressed at the board meeting yesterday, were around making sure that we had adequate payments for navigator services. I think there was just some confusion in the presentation, I thought. It made it look like we were cutting those. And, well, I am very much that we need to budget conservatively from Minsure and really just be very realistic about what enrollment is going to be. And then if we come in over it, that's good. We have additional money. So I am very much a proponent for the conservative budgeting, but I thought that it would be wrong to have cuts to navigator payments, because those are people who are helping us get people into the program, which will, one, get people coverage, most importantly, but also help with the budgetary issues.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. I think we all have great concern over that, and I think we see the problem with MNsure and the oversight. Number one, that they are overseeing their own budget. Number two, that the legislature has no ability to review, oversee, or appropriate these funds moving forward. And if the agency is set up without legislative oversight, it's just strictly through the board which you sit on and the governor. So I think that that is cause for great concern. I, as a member representing 40,000 people in the Northeast Metro, would like to see this brought back, and I'd like to understand if this is a real budget and it's not fake, that we should be able to see numbers and stand behind it, because we asked for that to be reported back to us, and I think that that's the minimum that we deserve to report back to our constituents.
Okay, thank you, Representative Dean, and members, that ends the testimony for now, but please keep your materials, because you're going to need them tonight when we come back, hopefully at 5 o'clock, depends on how long the session goes, so the meeting is...
How many witnesses do we have?
And we'll be in the basement hearing room.
How many witnesses are there? A dozen?
12.
Dozen's good.
No. So, and Representative Loeffler, you got a comment before we recess?
Mr. Chair, I was just going to say, in terms of the structure of MNsure, actually, some of us were more advocates of it being a state agency for the kind of accountability and transparency that Representative Dean just mentioned, but it was actually, I believe, more people of his party who really wanted it totally independent, not a state agency, and managed by people who would have broader experience.
That's not true. Okay. We will have a MNsure hearing, I can tell you, before we finish this session.
That will make Glenn happy.
And with that, this committee is in recess to the call of the chair. Back to order. And we have the list of testifiers in your today envelope in your packet. And so is Bruce Nelson here? There he is.
Did you
look
at the announcement?
Yes. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am Bruce Nelson with ARM. We're an association of providers that support people with disabilities across the state of Minnesota and ICF, BDs, waiver programs, in-home and whatnot. First off, we're gratified that the governor acknowledged the need for a rate increase with a 4% increase in his budget in a non-budget year. And for caregivers, for quality care, for provider stability, for people. At the same time, as you know, Representative Newton has, and many of you have co-authored, a bill for 5%. And we hope that we can work with you to find the resources to do a full 5% increase. As many of you know, over the past several years, since 2003, the net increases to home and community-based services has been 3.4%, while inflation has gone up 24.5%, and that's really hurt people, caregivers, in their pocketbook, and we were losing them because of the low wages and whatnot.
Could you get us a sheet, a one-page sheet that has that thing about what's happened compared to inflation?
I will do that, Mr. Chair. I might even have it on my folder. but we'll get that to you very quickly. The governor, in his budget, does set aside 1% for quality. And obviously, we all strive for quality. It's very broad language in there. But I want to remind you, too, that the single most important driver for quality is consistent care. And we are witnessing, because, in part, of low wages, increasing turnover of staff. And as they turn over, the quality, many parents tell us, the quality of the care is jeopardized. So I hope you can look at that as the first measure of quality. What the governor's proposed, we'll have to look at it in more detail, may be a good first start. At the same time, and moving more toward quality measures, at the same time, I would ask you, too, to look at the work of the Quality Council, which looks at quality from the front end rather than picking and choosing a few things on the back end and what providers do. I think it's meritorious and it's more systemic. There's language in the governor, not language, we haven't seen it, but provisions in the bill, a non-funding item on CFSS, and we'll be working with other folks in the disability community and want to work with you when we see the language on that. There's provision in the Jensen settlement relating to Rule 40, behavior modification. At ARM, we've been working on how we can move forward as a state to not use restraints and behavior modification that way. We think that's an imperative for this state. At the same time, we need to move in that direction carefully so that we're not jeopardizing the health and safety of people and of workers, but we can get there and we will get there. We want to see that language. Something that's not in the bill, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, is funding for a minimum wage increment. In our industry, people who are paid a minimum wage are paid to sleep. And at the same time, 97% of our funding comes from government. In other words, if there is an increase to, say, $9.50 for sleep time people, and there isn't a commensurate increase to cover that cost, that's going to squeeze whatever we get in a rate increase. For example, if it's 5%, our most current estimate is that it would be 3.9% that would be passed on to folks. A number of our providers are telling their staff that if we get 5%, you're getting 5%. But if the minimum wage passes at that level, at $9.50, and isn't paid for, they're going to have to turn around and say, but, however, we can only pay you 3.9% or whatever the number is. There is a provision in the minimum wage bill that would keep that at $7.25 for sleep time workers. We believe at ARM that a person who shows up at work ought to be paid a living wage to support his family. So it's kind of a moral conundrum of engaging in this discussion, but that's the reality of the world. Businesses are going to be asked to step up. This is government's obligation. Government should step up and cover their obligation, too. And we are working through you, Mr. Chair, and Doug Berg, with trying to get some numbers from the department to cost that out. My rough estimate is about $15 million, but that's my rough estimate, and I'm not a fiscal analyst. With that, Mr. Chair, we want to thank Governor Dayton and for putting 40% on the table. It's a lot of money in a non-budget year, and saying that, do urge you to do all you can to find the resources to provide a full 5% increase to home and community-based services.
Okay, any questions for Mr. Nelson? I don't see any, so thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And next is Toby Pearson, Care Providers of Minnesota. And it doesn't look like Toby Pearson to me. Welcome to the committee.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Heidi Holstein, representing Care Providers of Minnesota and the Long-Term Care Imperative. I'm here in place of Toby Pearson this evening. Like Mr. Nelson just testified, we do appreciate that the governor did recognize the needs of seniors and people with disabilities in including a 4% increase in his budget. We are members of the 5% campaign, and we are here tonight to say that we would appreciate a 5% increase, and anything that the legislature can do to bring that 4% up to 5% would be greatly appreciated. As you know, over the past 10 years or so, there have been different actions made by the legislature as well as the administration, which have averaged about 15% cuts to these providers. Last session, there was a 1.67% cut that was bought back and a 1% increase going forward in April. And we do appreciate that. However, the needs are great, and we would like to see a 5% increase passed. I would like to briefly comment on the quality piece of the governor's budget. We haven't seen the language, but we do appreciate the flexible nature of that quality component. There is not a robust measurement of quality in our state at this time, and so anything that we can do to make this a little bit easier to implement for providers, that is also helpful. It is important for us to see the language, and we do commit to working with DHS as well as all of you to make that as flexible and implementable, that's a word, as possible. So with that, I can take any questions, but Ms. Thurlow is here to represent the other side of our association.
Questions? Well, then we'll go to Ms. Thurlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm the Senior Vice President of Advocacy at Aging Services of Minnesota, and I join Ms. Holste in representing the long-term care imperative tonight. And as Ms. Holste said, I'm here to represent the other portions of our provider membership, which are the care centers. And as I told the Senate committee yesterday, I'm going to acknowledge that probably my message is probably not the most popular message that you'll hear tonight, because we are compelled to point out that there is no additional funding for care centers in the governor's budget. I want to first say thank you, and we acknowledge that last year there was a much needed funding increase for care centers, an average 5% rate increase for care centers that was given, which was very much needed and appreciated. But there is no funding increase in the budget for care centers, and I am here to tell you that our needs are still continuing. There is no funding system for care centers. There is no mechanism beyond an appropriation for care centers to get increases, and we remain constrained by the amount of rates that you set. And at the same time, we struggle with recruitment and retention. And while rates aren't the only answer to that solution, it is a big problem. I know you're not here tonight to talk about what the imperative is talking about, but we have outlined three important funding requests for care centers this year. The first being an additional 5% increase for care centers for this year of the budget. That was included in our ask last year, and unfortunately, that half of the ask was not included, so we are back to ask for that this year. In addition, we know with the minimum wage discussions, as many of you have heard from us already this session, we are looking for an increase to help offset those new costs, and we have presented with many of you with that particular proposal and look forward to those continued discussions. And then last but not least is funding assistance to help with renovation and replacement of old nursing homes through the moratorium exception process. If no money is appropriated to that fund this year, there will be no funds available for those major improvements. The state does get a fairly good return for that investment, with every $1 million put into that fund providing about $70 million of construction for nursing homes. So with that, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we look forward to conversations on those needs, and I'd be happy to answer any questions in that regard.
Questions? Representative Abler.
Well, thanks, and I wish that this was new information, but it's good you remind us about the information we need to hear. I hope there'd be a way to sneak a little bit of money into that moratorium thing. That's such a leveraged way, and some of these, with the moratorium, there's some of these places that are old. That it would just be nice to do that. If you just to add to the load, Mr. Chair, and that was not meant to be clever to make it a bit more difficult, but there's actually a really good value in that. I know you know that, so thank you.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I was wondering if the chair or the testifiers, has anyone looked at having some uplift factor that would take into account the average years of experience at a facility? Therefore, there would be a benefit to having and retaining, and there also would be a mechanism to provide additional funding for the salaries, because I agree that if you have retention of staff, you can improve the quality and give them more effective. And I just wasn't sure, not having been here for years and years, if anyone ever looked at some kind of a factor like that to help promote retention.
Either one of you wish to respond?
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, it's a really interesting idea, and certainly we are open to many different mechanisms that would help our retention efforts. I haven't mentioned tonight that we do have a workforce package that might help at some of those efforts, but we have suggestion specifically, we haven't looked at it, but we'd be willing to have conversations if that's something that you'd like to work with us on.
Okay. Well, thank you for your testimony, and we'll see what we can do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Next is Ann Henry from the Disability Law Center. And we have a...
handout
from her.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Ann Henry, and I'm with the Minnesota Disability Law Center. And yes, there should be a handout at your table. Echo support that the governor recognized the need for community service providers' rate increase, but want to focus tonight on a budget page which is missing something. And it's on page 7. There's a budget page on community first services and supports, which is what our PCA program will be called when Minnesota gets federal approval. The issue that I want to raise that I think has a significant budget impact is the fact that last session the legislature passed the CFSS / PCA, that's how I try to refer to it so people know what we're talking about. The legislature passed the new legislation, and that meant that we would get 6% additional federal match for our entire PCA program. So it brings the state share cost of PCA down. Unfortunately, due to cost last session, we did not change one provision that we believe is required by federal law, and we think it is in the way of getting federal approval for our program. And that is, our definition of dependency is more restrictive than federal law provides, and it has a discriminatory impact. It, especially on people with mental illnesses, brain injuries, and developmental disabilities. These are people who need supervision and queuing to get through the day, to get up, to take care of their personal hygiene, to eat, to get to their appointments, take medication, but they don't have physical disabilities. So they're at a disadvantage in our current PCA program, and this happened in 2009. Some of you will well remember we had some very deep cuts in the PCA program that year, and one of them was to set up this restrictive dependency definition in 2009. So we still have that in our law, and at the end of last session, because of the changes in the program, $41 million was assumed that we would get in the 6%. Now it seems that while Minnesota submitted our program for federal approval, some of you may recall that Assistant Commissioner Lauren Coleman testified before you that CMS was having questions, and this was the issue he mentioned, our restrictive dependency definition. So we want to raise this because, of course, we think there are many good policy reasons not to have this restriction. But now we think that obtaining federal approval is also at risk, which would mean that we don't get that 6% federal match and we couldn't move forward with a lot of the reforms that are in that program. So I would be happy to answer any questions. We think one more thing to let you know, and I think the commissioner this morning indicated that the department tells us that they do not disagree with the policy that we are seeking. In other words, to remove the word constant from our dependency definition. They say they don't have the money. So their estimate of how much this would cost is $19 million per year. As I said, last session they booked $41 million for the biennium, and in the future that would go up. We'd have to ask them, but it was in the neighborhood of $35 to $40 million per year down the road. So we think that the federal government provided extra money for states in order to improve their PCA programs and not discriminate and assure that people could live in the community independently, and that our state ought to comply with that. Thank you.
So, Ms. Henry, you're saying, if I understand this, that they're saying that what they're applying for would bring $41 million into the state. But if we don't get it, then we're... and, you know, I agree with you that it depends what the feds are going to decide on this. The other thing is, if we change the current definition of dependency, then that would cost us $19 million of state money, but we would still bring in the $41 million, so we'd be about $20 million bucks ahead.
Mr. Chair, yes, but last session they did use that $41 million for the biennium in a variety of ways. They didn't use it for this, but they accounted for it at the end of session.
Okay. Any questions? Nope, don't see any. So thank you for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
Next is Rebecca Covington from the Minnesota Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good evening, Chairman Huntley, committee members. Thank you for providing me the opportunity to speak with you this evening about an issue that is very important to the disability community. And it's an issue that falls under two of the overarching priorities of the governor's DHS budget. Those two are optimal health for all of Minnesota and strong and stable communities. And specifically, I'm going to be speaking to the medical assistance, or MA, income spend down and asset limit that are applied to individuals with disabilities and older adults in order for these populations to access medical assistance. Now, you may remember last session when we passed a law that went into effect January 1st of this year that created a new adult expansion group. And that raised the income eligibility to 138% of federal poverty guidelines and got rid of that asset limit for that group. Unfortunately, this left seniors and individuals with disabilities behind. And the disability community continues to live under a policy which for decades has impoverished individuals within that community and the elderly. This policy affects over 12,000 Minnesotans. The spend-down requires these individuals who have an income just a dollar over 100% of the federal poverty guideline, which is $958 a month, so if they make a dollar over that, they need to spend down to 75% of the federal poverty guideline, which is $719 a month to live on, and they have an asset limit of $3,000. So although they may own a home, own a car, and those assets are disregarded, they have only $3,000 of assets that they can retain to, say, fix the roof on their house, buy a new refrigerator, or repair their car. We have seen the Olmstead Plan shift the priority in our society and in our state from life in an institution to supporting individuals with disabilities as they transition to greater independence in community-based settings of their own choosing. Our state now has an opportunity to more fully realize the promise of Olmstead by working to eliminate the MA income spend down and asset limit. I feel we need to address this inequitable policy and promote changes that would raise the income limit for individuals with disabilities and seniors up to the same level as other adults who live in the same communities, pay the same bills, and shop in the same stores. To achieve optimal health for all of Minnesota, we also need to have equitable access to health care. We feel that this was work left undone last session and would like to ask the committee to consider this a priority for the budget. Thank you very much for your time this evening.
Okay, I'm a little confused here, but on the spend down
yep.
thing, why aren't these people just, if they're below 130 or if they're up to 138% of poverty, why don't we just put them on medical assistance?
Ann is here. She can answer a couple technical details, because I don't know the history of why we have the spend down, and I know it doesn't make sense to a lot of folks in this room as to why that exists, but we know that for these two populations, they still have that spend down that they have to incur to get covered by MA.
Mr. Chair, this is Ann Henry, Disability Law Center. I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear the question. These people are on medical assistance, but they're in a different eligibility group than the new MA expansion group, and they basically didn't get an increase in their income limit.
So we can't eliminate it from the program that they're in now and just say they're below 138% of poverty and they don't have kids.
Mr. Chair, we are encouraging people who can do that to do it because it is more favorable, but federal law prevents people who are either on SSI or have Medicare from qualifying for the new adult expansion group. So we have a group of people that can't qualify for the new group. Otherwise, yes, that would be happening. But it can't happen for everyone. So that's the reason for the effort.
Their income, then, is coming from SSI.
Actually,
because they're working or what?
I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, actually, the income for the people on a spend down is mainly their Social Security, because if they were on SSI, they would only have 100% of the poverty level, and they would not have a spend down. So these are people who have Social Security, either they've worked or it also affects seniors, retired, and it's their Social Security that we expect them to pay for their health care.
Are there any questions? Thank you for your testimony, both of you.
Thank you.
Next is Steve Larson. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Larson.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Steve Larson, the Senior Policy Director for the ARC Minnesota. And I first want to thank the governor for his 4% in the his supplemental budget. And Kurt Rutzen will talk more about that when he comes up to testify. I'm here tonight not only as my role with the ARC, but as co-chair of the State Quality Council. And I just want Representative Abler to pay attention because I'm going to do some complaining and whining tonight, which is not something I typically do when I come up here. But I want to direct you to page 9 on the governor's supplemental budget handout. And you'll see there on page 9 that in the Jensen settlement, the state is recommending that, and I support the payment of this, but I'm going to elaborate a little bit why I'm concerned about it. We're going to pay 1.4 in fiscal year 15, another 1.8 in fiscal year 16, and so on and so on and so on. And so what the state continues to do is it continues to pay to clean up messes that have happened, because we don't have a proactive quality assurance system in place for the $2 billion worth of home and community-based services that we have going right now. So
was that $2
billion? $2 billion that we spent.
Okay, B, not M.
Right. Yes, Mr. Chair. So in addition to the money that's listed on page 9, we're going to pay another $315,000, according to the commissioner, to pay for the special master. I'll remind you that in 2011, on December 2nd, a settlement was made, and $3 million was paid in that settlement to the 390 people that are referenced on page 390. In addition to that $3 million, I would guess that there were millions of dollars spent on attorney fees to get ready for that case. We're also going to be paying for the Olmstead Implementation Office efforts, which we also support the payment of that, but that's also the result of that case. Let me remind you how the Jensen case got started. We developed a state program within the past 12 years. It became very rapidly isolated. Individuals living there were not only shackled and handcuffed, as the commissioner said this morning, but they were also threatened if they told anybody about it. One of the individuals there with cognitive disabilities was brave enough to tell his parents. His parents told an ARC advocate. The ARC advocate got the ombudsman involved. The ombudsman wrote the report just plain wrong. That led to the Jensen lawsuit, et cetera, et cetera. So Minnesota can continue to spend its time and money cleaning up a variety of messes, or we can do like the House of Representatives has done and support House File 1897. And let's start getting funding for the State Quality Council and move forward so that we're acting proactively. The State Quality Council has a framework that we've proposed a year ago in the report that would involve persons with disabilities. There is, in the current licensing system, very little opportunity for the voice of persons with disabilities to be heard. And another point I wanted to make about the MITO settlement, that program was licensed. So being licensed does not assure quality. And so we really think that we need to move forward, and in addition to cleaning up the things that have happened in the past, we need to spend some money up front so that we're administering this program according to what the federal government wants, but not only what the federal government wants, but what is really necessary on behalf of persons with disabilities to move forward. So again, I'm asking the House, you have been our champion for the past 15 years, starting with funding for the Region 10 Quality Commission. You've been our champion in advocating for the start of the State Quality Council in 2011 when legislation was passed, when Representative Abler was chair here. But we weren't included in the governor's budget last year. We're not included in the governor's budget this year. And so we want to have this included in the HHS supplemental budget, and we'd like to do the work that is necessary in order to do the right things for all persons with disabilities. So if I didn't complain or whine enough, let me know, and I'll continue for a while longer.
What's the dollar amount that the Quality Council was getting?
Fiscal year, we had several hundred thousand dollars to start off with in 2011, and that in biennium for 2012 and 2013. We didn't receive any funding. There was a $2 million that we needed in order to start work this biennium.
So is the council meeting?
The council is meeting. The Department of Human Services has found some resources out of their current budget in order for the council to meet, but we can't proceed with starting regional councils. We can't do the types of surveys we want. We can't do the data review that is necessary. We can't do any of those things. We can meet and start planning to do those things, but we can't complete those tasks unless we get funding. And by the way, I'm a volunteer co-chair. There's not a nickel of my money that comes from the state to support my position. My position is supported through donations and clothing donations, that type of thing. Lance Hagelin is a person with disabilities that serves on the committee. He's a complete volunteer. We're willing to get together with a wide variety of people, parents, county representatives, DHS staff, to do the work. We just need the support through the $2 million allocation to really do the work that needs to be done here.
Representative Abler.
Well, I just we look for new financing mechanisms. I've never heard of donating clothing to lobbyists. That's a nice tie. I wonder who had that before, Mr. Anyway.
I think it came from someone in Anoka.
Representative Norton was the author of that bill before, just to give due credit. So it's good when we all work together. And, Mr. Chair, I like his testimony. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Larson. And members that came after we started, there's a sheet in your envelope that has the list of people that are going to testify. It's in today's handout folder. And now we have Kurt Rutzen. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you so much for having me, Chair and members. First of all, my name is Kurt Rutzen with the Arc of Minnesota. I would like to thank the governor for the 4% increase. But as we all sit here tonight, this is a 5% increase campaign. And I'm asking, as well as other people, for 5%. And I would appreciate that so much. As I said, my name is Kurt, and I'm with the ARC of Minnesota. Along with that, I'm on the ARC National Board now in Washington, D.C., and I was the past chair of the Region 10 in Southeast Minnesota. I'd like to talk to you this evening briefly about the 5% increase, not the 4% increase, the 5% increase. I had an ILS worker, her name is Bob. She was an amazing, amazing woman. She helped me in things that I could talk hours about the paperwork when I needed to fill it out. And there was many, many times I didn't myself even understand the paperwork for the county. She helped me immensely. She quit and took another job, and I'm sure it was for a little higher pay. And it just crushed me. And she was amazing. And she was just she helped me out whatever I would need. And she was incredible. And I know that she took another job for higher pay. That's just the facts, you guys. I mean, these PCAs love it. But when you're trying to support a family and maybe 6 kids on what they're making, they work like 3 or 4 jobs. And the person they get tired. They get wore out. Don't you guys ever get tired, wore out? I know Jim Abel does. But that's another story for another time. another thing is, as I said, and you guys will understand this. I was talking to somebody in the hall. Like it or not, you guys, these PCAs, if we can get a 5% increase and build on that, they come in and get trained. And that costs a lot. And then, like it or not, you guys, they do some pretty intimate, you know, they help these people pretty intimately. Mm-hmm. They help them bathe and shower and other stuff. And if every other week there's somebody new doing that for them, I will be scared to death. Well, tonight, John's going to be with you. Next week, Bob might be with you. I will be horrified. I will be terrified. So let's raise the wage so we can keep these people for a long, long time and build on the same person for Sally, or John, or Bob. And that, I think that would be great, and that would take care of the problem. And it's a start, at least 5%. You all know they deserve, like I told my partner, 25%, let's go. But we will start with 5. And see what happens. Not 4, but 5. Thank you for your time. I appreciate you guys more than you ever know. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Any questions?
Roots, and are there any questions? Very dramatic testimony.
No questions.
I don't see any questions, so thank you. I don't think Sue Adverholden is here.
No, Tim Burkett's going to go for
interviews. Okay. Okay. Not Tim Burkett.
Or sorry, it's Matt Burdick.
Matt Burdick.
Yes.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Matt Burdick, Grassroots Advocacy Coordinator with NAMI Minnesota, standing in for Sue Adverholden for the second time this week. So good to be back here. Just want to touch on a few things. Overall perspective on the governor's budget, we were a little disappointed to not see a little heftier investment in health and human services, and in particular, the issues that we care about in our community mental health system. We took a lot of really huge cuts during the recession period. The adult mental health grants were cut by $10 million, $12 million. Some of the children's programs took some pretty serious cuts. And we did some great work last year to start rebuilding our community mental health system. But even in that setting, we had to cut further from the adult mental health grants last year to restructure our ARMS providers. And so we want to see some of the initiatives to start rebuilding our fragile mental health system included, and we hope that there's room within the Health and Human Services budget to start making some progress in that direction. I also want to echo Ann Henry's comments about the CFSS program. When the changes to the PCA program came in 2009, people with mental illnesses were one of the hardest hit, particularly children. And continuing this eligibility criteria that has that word constant in the definition really is going to make it difficult for people to access this new program. And we think it's going to be a vital service that we want people to have access to so they can receive that support, so that they can stay out of the hospital and be successful in the community. And we really hope that that's something that can be part of this budget picture and move that program forward in a way that our folks can access that. And one final thing I want to touch on, and I'm going to wade very cautiously into this because it's far outside of our main area of expertise, but that's the hospital rebasing. And previously when this went forward, inpatient psychiatric units were hit disproportionately. They often have a higher percentage of folks on MA, and there's also been some issues with the relation with the new ICD-10 codes and the new DSM-5 and how those fit together. So as you look at the hospital rebasing, just pay close attention to those inpatient psychiatric units to make sure that they are not being negatively impacted by that, so that resource can stay viable there. Thank you.
Here are there questions? Oh, thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we have Deb Konecny. Yeah. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify in the governor's budget proposal. My name is Deb Konecny, and I am here to speak on behalf of the Welfare Rights Committee. And the Welfare Rights Committee is very unhappy with the governor's budget proposal because it continues a terrible situation for the poorest of the poor in this state. For years, programs like MFIP have seen cuts during times of budget deficits. Now that there is a surplus, does the governor repay that money? No. Instead, he gives over $600 million in tax breaks to many who are well off or to businesses. I want to talk about what is not in the governor's budget. In particular, the governor does not pay back even one dime of the TANF funds that have been raided over the years. The TANF fund, as you know, is the federal block grant that goes to the state of Minnesota to run the state's welfare program for poor families. Over the years, money has been taken from the TANF fund to replace what used to be and what still should be general fund spending. This actually adds up to hundreds of millions of dollars that have been raided. Currently, only 27% of the federal TANF funds actually go to the families on welfare. MFIP cash grants for the poorest families have not been increased since 1986, 28 years ago. We have testified to this year after year. The cost of living has more than doubled since 86. The monthly cash grant for a family of two is $437 a month. These low cash grants mean that 70,000 Minnesota kids are living not just in poverty, but in extreme poverty, over 60% below the federal poverty level. This has a devastating effect on our children. And yet the governor, in his budget proposal, ignores these children and the stress and misery they endure every single day. And really, it's like a slap in the face to poor families, what this budget does not do. It is like a slap in the face to the 70,000 children who live in extreme poverty, children who the governor would have the power to lift out of extreme poverty overnight. That's how quickly it could happen if the will was there to do it. But I find it quite interesting hearing that the governor talks about optimal health and strong and stable communities in his budget proposal. I can't think of anything that is more important for optimal health and strong and stable communities than to not have families living in such desperation and not have kids that are trying to figure out where they're going to be sleeping every night. Apparently, Governor Dayton thinks that after all these years of deficits and cuts, that this year's surplus still cannot possibly be used on the poor. Poor families have been told year after year to tighten their belts even more because there is a budget deficit. And now, when there's a huge surplus, we are being told yet again that there is not money to be given to the poor, that the poor once again will be passed by this year. There are a lot of worthy expenditures that the governor is funding, like the 4% increase, and we support all that. But honestly, there is not one other group of people in this state, there is not one other program that has gone 28 years without a cost of living increase. Imagine that. We call for the surplus to be used to repay the TANF dollars that have been raided. In other words, use the TANF money for TANF families grants and replace any holes with general fund dollars. We call for the welfare grants to get the long overdue increase now, this year, not next year, not the year after that. This has been ignored for far too long. And right now there are bills that will get money to MFIP families, and we call on the governor and legislators to put the poorest of the poor children first and pass these bills and start the process to end extreme poverty in Minnesota. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Is there questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next we have Jonathan Watson. Welcome to the committee.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. With me today is Gordon Apple. He's on the agenda just beneath me, so we're going to do this together. So thank you. Thank you again for providing the opportunity for us to comment on the DHS part of the governor's budget. I'm from the Federally Qualified Health Centers. Again, my name is Jonathan Watson. We serve about 185,000 low-income individuals. Roughly 40% of them are uninsured. Another 40% are on Medicaid or Minnesota Care. There are 17 of these organizations that provide services at about 60 different sites throughout the state. I want to just quickly draw your attention to pages 14 and 15 in the budget document. It's titled The Streamlining of Payment Processes to the Federally Qualified Health Centers. I am in strong opposition to this provision. I'm going to tell you why here today. But just for some background, under federal law, the Federally Qualified Health Centers in this state are given a per-encounter Medicaid rate per federal law. The Department of Human Services basically is charged with settling up the payments. So we get a payment from a managed care entity for Medicaid patients, we settle up to that federally prescribed rate under through DHS. The settle-up process, however, has really been fraught with difficulty over the last 10 years. Twice there have been two backlogs that have exceeded over $5 million to our collective 17 community health centers. This really does force our nonprofit community health centers to go out, establish lines of credit. We have to pay that interest. We'd rather have those dollars go to serving the low-income uninsured that we serve annually. I have one example in greater Minnesota. We have a health center up in Cook, Minnesota that has about $200,000 in outstanding payments due to them from the department dating back to 2003. Under the governor's proposal, they would just be able to write this debt off because it exceeds that two-year window. The same health center started a clinic in Tower of May in 2013. They've submitted 796 claims to the Department of Human Services for Medicaid. They've been paid for 36 of those. So they're about 14 months away from having the rest of those claims be written off under the governor's proposal. Lastly, the system forced six of our health centers to actually sue the Department of Human Services in 2011. The settlement terms were fairly explicit in that it said that the department and the federally qualified health center should work together to iron out the differences in this methodology. The proposal in the governor's budget came pretty much out of left field, in my opinion. We were not consulted whatsoever on that. So Mr. Gordon-Apple is going to talk a little bit about the settlement terms on that. However, really at the heart of the matter, we have the system that is really clearly unworkable if we have 10 years of backlog payments. Given these continued problems without any resolution, this arbitrary two-year window would have a devastating impact on community health centers. We don't need any more uncompensated care. We have 40% uninsured. We have plenty of uncompensated care. We don't need to add to that given the actions in the governor's budget. So again, we're disappointed. We continue to offer to work with the department. We actually have a meeting with them tomorrow, which is a positive sign. We can talk about that. But I just want to be on the record of opposing this two-year window contained in the governor's budget. So if I could just turn it over to Mr. Gordon Apple, who is the association, represents the association.
If I could ask a question first, Mr. Watson, so what you're saying, this is money that, or bills that you submitted to the Department of Human Services and for medical assistance, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, the precise technical answer to that question is actually it's two data streams essentially coming to the department. The managed care organizations are also submitting data on our behalf. That's going into the department, and the department is not seeing some of our claims in that data stream, even though we have proof of that services being paid. So a lot of this could be rectified with the department using community health center data in addition to the managed care, because there is a mismatch in data between those two feeds.
And so this is money, however, the state owes you.
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
And they're saying, well, if we can't pay it for 2 years, then that's your out of luck.
Mr. Chair, that's my interpretation of the proposal. Again, the only details I know of it are what's contained in the budget pages. I haven't had any conversations with how this would work with department staff.
Thank you, and let's go on to Mr. Apple.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for allowing me to testify. My name is Gordon Apple. I'm an attorney, health law attorney in St. Paul. I've been practicing in the community since 1986, back in the Ramsey Clinic days. I represented the six community health centers that were involved in the lawsuit against the state of Minnesota. You have the settlement agreement in front of you. That lawsuit was filed in 2009, not in 2011, as Mr. Watson had said. The lawsuit was filed because of the fact of all the problems that the clinics had had with respect to the settle-up process with respect to Medicaid managed care payments from the state of Minnesota. And at the time, the things were so dire that we, in addition to filing the lawsuit in federal court, we also filed a motion for preliminary injunction with Federal District Judge Doty and received a preliminary injunction requiring the state to comply with federal law at that point in time, also in 2009. In 2011, the settlement agreement that you have in front of you and that has been signed by lots of folks, including myself and representatives of the department, was agreed upon, and it talks about how the supplemental payment process can work, how it should work in compliance with federal law, and then it also contains, and this is sort of the nub of the matter, an agreed-upon payment and problem resolution process. We anticipated that there would be problems in terms of the payment process. Sometimes those problems are FQHC problems, other times they're MCO problems, and other times they're department problems. And we agreed in the settlement agreement as to how those should be handled. That's the main reason why today we're a little bit taken aback. But in any event, the agreement as you have in front of you, it talks about the term is for 10 years until 2021. It's binding on the parties, and most importantly of all, it says to the extent we have issues in the future, we should meet in good faith and try and figure out a way to do that. In fact, that has worked, at least up until now. In fact, the fall of last year, I did meet with attorneys for DHS with respect to One of the plaintiffs who had 6 years of past claims that they've been trying to get settled with the department. We met. I said, look, folks, here's what the settlement agreement says. The process should be. We need to follow this. They didn't disagree with that, and we were able to reach agreement as to how the payment should proceed. And that was last fall. As a result of those meetings, however, one of the things the department said to me is we want to meet with the association to talk about how can we improve this reconciliation process, the supplemental payment process, because both sides recognized there were issues associated with it. So in December of last year, Mr. Watson reached out to DHS saying, you know, our attorney says you want to have a meeting, let's meet. In fact, you know, they responded, yes, we do want to meet with you. And we recently met with them in February of this year to discuss the terms of how to improve the payment process and also how to develop a more consistent reconciliation process so that monies owed were being paid appropriately and timely. So we met with them on in February, and it wasn't until yesterday morning that either Mr. Watson and I became aware of this change that's being proposed in the supplemental budget. So you can see why we're a bit surprised and taken aback. When we meet with DHS tomorrow, and as my understanding is we still have that meeting, we'll be informing them that in our opinion the proposal that they put forth violates the terms of the settlement agreement and certainly the spirit of the agreement, and that proposal should be withdrawn. We'll also say that we're willing to work with DHS, and we want to work with them in terms of improving the process because there continue to be substantial problems, some of which Mr. Watson just talked about. We have to assume, quite frankly, that the language that was drafted was done by somebody who didn't have the input of those that were involved in the settlement process, and we hope that that assumption is correct. So that's the status. We thought it was important that you knew about the settlement agreement. It's a public document. It takes a little bit to look and find, but it's there. So thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for providing me with the opportunity to testify, and I'm more than happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Right. Representative Abler.
Well, thanks. Actually, I almost forgot to mention today is Tom Huntley Day, declared by the governor, and I didn't. Some people in the audience didn't know that, so that's a pretty good honor for a chair as good as him, so it couldn't happen to a better guy.
I was very disappointed. I thought that would entitle me to a free beer in the governor's office, but the answer was no.
Well, maybe at that fishing there, you might get one yet today, Mr. Chair. I think a lot of people in the audience actually enjoy a good beer now and then. Anyway, we could have used some last night, that's for sure. Anyway, so to the witnesses, and in the same way we could celebrate our chair, I think we can celebrate the quality effectiveness of the community health clinics and what they do and how far they stretch a dollar. And I'm just simply really shocked that this is an open issue and that you even had to go to court. When I was, we make our chair jokes back and forth, but there's certain groups you can count on as a policymaker to do what you ask them to do. Some other groups, well, will they do it or not? But this group of all the groups takes a dollar and stretches it as far as it can go. And unfortunately, there's no senior DHS staff here. There's some good liaisons here, and hopefully they'll be listening to this discussion. But I'm just frankly appalled that you had to go to court to get paid what you do for what you do there, as little as you get and how far as you stretch it, and given the reputation and all that. And so I intend to weigh in as I can along the way. And I know our good chair is interested too, I suppose, speaking for him. But I we need to figure out more what this proposal is, and maybe it's not what you think it is. Maybe it's, but if it is what you think it is, then I'm just going to have to jump up and down too. But Mr. Chair, I think there's different bills I've had in the past. I'm trying to get a few more million dollars to these folks, and of all the groups that you could put money toward, it would be this group, and the way they reach out with the disparities work they do. And in the underserved populations and the EMA populations and all of that. So I just wanted to speak up on behalf of one member's view and the worthiness of the operations they conduct and my willingness to engage in a productive way. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I, too, am surprised that anything could be 6 years old and still be dragged. I don't know how some of these small nonprofits can handle the cash flow issues, quite honestly, given the populations that some of them have served. And I think it'd be useful for us as a committee just to better understand the issue, to find out if this is an aberration for this particular group of providers that have this unique status that gets them paid cost as opposed to, you know, other providers and that sort of thing, or if this is something that there's just been a growing backlog because of staff cutbacks or computer system problems or whatever, and that there are other providers that are also kind of caught up in this web, because I know once you get behind, it's hard to ever move ahead. But it would just be useful to know whether this is an aberration that you had to deal with, or if there's some system issues that we need to be aware of and help address.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Loeffler, this has really been a consistent issue, and I just don't, for the FQHCs, but I also want to, we don't represent the rural health clinics, and there are 60 of those across the state of Minnesota, too, that are paid underneath the same way that we are. I don't know if they're suffering from these issues as well. They don't have an organized association that I'm aware of. So you keep in mind that there are those organizations that are impacted by this as well. And just to your issue about other payment processes, I'm hearing more and more recently about critical access dental provider payments being delayed to CADPs, to those providers, just in the last 6 months or so. So it's something that we're keeping an eye on, too, because we do receive those funds, but it's just kind of cropped up recently. So just to put you on alert for that as well.
Mr. Watson, could you refresh my mind on rural health clinics? I understand the FQHCs, but what's a rural health clinic?
Rural health clinic, Mr. Chair, a rural health clinic is, you could look at it as a cousin, maybe as an FQHC. The primary difference is they're smaller entities, and they're located in areas where access truly is an issue, so they use a lot of mid-level practitioners, if you will, in terms of delivering care. The fundamental difference is they get this Medicaid payment as we do. The big difference is they don't receive a grant from the federal government that partially offsets the cost of care for the uninsured. They don't have the near volume and percentage of the uninsured that we have, but nonetheless they do serve some uninsured. So those are the key differences between them.
Other questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
And why don't you send me an email tomorrow after your meeting with the Department of Human Services?
Will do. Thank you.
Mary Krinke from the Hospital Association. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. I'd like to talk tonight about the Medicaid modernization, the payment portion, number 6 under the governor's budget proposal. This legislation is not, let me repeat, not technical in nature. It represents significant payment changes to our inpatient fee-for-service program. Regretfully, this proposal will probably be arriving very late in the legislative session, which will make it very difficult for the Hospital Association as well as the public to really analyze the proposal and its impact to all of the hospitals. There are 5 different components of this proposal that I would like to just briefly mention to you. The first one Commissioner Jessen mentioned today, and that is the implementation of the ICD-10. And I know in healthcare we use way too many abbreviations, but this stands for the International Classification of Diseases. And we are currently in the ICD-9, and we will be billing through the ICD-9 until September 30th. Then on October 1, magically, we have to start billing under the ICD-10. The department has no choice. They have to implement this change in order to be paid by CMS. So the department is in a little bit of a predicament in that we do have to move forward with this piece of the legislation. So we will be moving to ICD-10 effective October 1 of 2014. The second portion of this that is also kind of a moving component is what the commissioner referred to today, was moving to a new grouper. And a grouper is not a fish, okay? A grouper is, we're moving to what is called an APRDRG. And this stands for, another abbreviation, this stands for the All Patient Refined diagnoses-related group. And the reason it is an all-patient is because if you think about Medicare, Medicare was obviously for seniors, and so they have to incorporate things like pediatrics, OB, and other services that are not traditionally billed through Medicare. And states all around the country are starting to adopt this type of payment system in their Medicaid program. So it is a complication that we, quite frankly, don't know what it is going to mean to all of our individual members. That said, that doesn't mean that it's bad, okay? This is just a new way of paying the hospitals, very similar to Medicare. The third piece of this that makes this even more complicated is that, as you all may recall, in 2011, the legislature passed budget-neutral rebasing. I'm looking at Representative Loeffler here on this one because she mentioned this morning. Budget-neutral rebasing of our state Medicaid rates, which means they're cutting up the Medicaid pie differently to reflect costs. Right now, we are paid on 2002 costs, minus 26%. So they are going to move that to 2012 costs in a budget-neutral manner. So quite frankly, we don't know who the financial, I hate to use the term winners, but we don't know who the net winners will be to the hospitals and who the net losers will be to the hospitals. Now, number four, in the proposal, they are talking about potentially eliminating some of the current add-on payments to our hospitals, the small rural add-on, the 16 rural DRG, as well as changing perhaps some of the DSH payments. Now, they're hoping to be able to incorporate that into the base payment, so it doesn't mean that the hospitals will necessarily lose that funding, but it will no longer be an add-on. So we're going to have to try to track that to see what the impact is going to be. And the fifth and the last one I want to mention is the readmissions work, and I was very pleased by the commissioner's comments today. In the 2011 legislation, there was a proposal, provision that went into law, that said the 10% rateable reduction, half of it could be bought back if the hospitals met a readmissions target. And I'm very pleased to say that our hospitals have been doing great work on reducing avoidable readmissions. And I think we are pretty darn close to meet the overall goal of that. Our finance people are working with the department now to track the readmissions. But we're hoping that we can time this at the same time the rebasing goes through, because if we can get a 5% buyback at the same time rebasing happens, maybe those hospitals that are very negatively impacted by rebasing will not have as hard of hit from the rebasing. So I know that this is very complicated. I feel the department's pain, but and I wish I could tell you all, quite frankly, that I knew what the impact was going to be to the hospitals. I don't. I also want to comment on something that the NAMI organization said, and I know you don't know where your budget targets are, but I think this is extremely important. What happens with rebasing, it tends to benefit services that have high technology uses, and it tends to undervalue services that are more people-oriented, that maybe are done with counseling and not as much technological inputs. And I am a little worried that the mental health services could see devaluation in the rebasing. So if there is money that could be targeted in this committee, we might want to ask for some additional resources to the mental health DRGs. I don't know that, but that could be something that we might want to be able to ask for and to look at. So, Mr. Chairman, I would like to offer to this committee that the Hospital Association would be happy to meet with individuals. We're going to be meeting with the department very, very regularly. I just wanted to go on the record to say that this is a little bit more complicated than I think most of us realized because of all the different moving components of this. So, I'm happy to answer any questions. I don't want to leave the committee with the notion that this is bad public policy. I just wish it had come earlier in session, and we'd be able to understand it a little bit better. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Just for the members' information, basically the department said they can't tell us who the winners are and who the losers are until sometime in the summer. So we're going to have to vote on the bill, and we won't know how it's affecting our own individual hospital. If that would switch your vote, Representative Abert.
Well, thanks, and Mr. Chair and Ms. Krinke. So these new rates are effective. Rebasing would be January 1st.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Abler, the legislation that was passed in 2011 called for rebasing to start January 1 of 2013. So the department is, by law, a little behind. That said, I think they're going to try to time this for October 1, 2014, so that it lines up with the must-do of the ICD-10. So I think the new rebased rates will start October 1.
Mr. Chair, and this is a state decision that we set the time. That we made up the date 2013, right? That was a legislative choice.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, there was nothing in federal law that picked that date. It was the wishes of the legislators at that time. That is correct.
Mr. Chair, it might be ICD-10 could just be a nightmare. As it unfolds, Representative Grunberg is not here to discuss another project that didn't go as smoothly as we thought. But this is going to, it's very complicated diagnosing, and it's a lot of sub points, and if you don't have it right, you're not going to get paid, and it's mammoth. And so we just might want to consider pushing out the rebasing until the first of the year, just at our choice, so at least one less thing wouldn't have to blow up, and so people, there would be no losers. In that time, at least they could count on some stability, and then you do the second instability, and then actually the legislature could act if it just was totally awful. Just a thought. So,
Ms. Krinke. Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. To that point, Ms. Krinke, what, if you know, what's the big rush, or is there a rush?
Mr. Chairman, and to both of these points from the legislature, the last time we did rebasing was in 2007, and while there are certainly hospitals that may end up on the short end of the stick, we are getting a lot of pressure from the hospitals who believe they will also be net winners. So the question is, what is fairness? And fairness is often in the eyes of the beholder, as you all well know. And so there are some hospitals that are very anxious who feel like they have been on the short end of not having their rates rebased. So the department is under considerable pressure to move forward with this, I think, as quickly as they can.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm trying to dust off the memory banks of rebasing. But since we're going to be changing from ICD-9 to ICD-10, is it even possible for us to, is rebasing become even more complicated if you are already on a whole new set of coding and organizing of data to even be able, I mean, then you really do, I think, get some apples to oranges comparisons that might make it more difficult?
Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, I would just like to say one thing, if I may, about the ICD-10. We haven't had any new codes for over 30 years, and hospitals are now doing procedures that weren't in existence 30 years ago. So we really do need, even if it's going to be complicated, we really do need to move forward with the ICD-10, because 30 years ago, a lot of the things we're currently doing weren't in the codes. So we are kind of at a point where we really feel like we need to move forward with that, and obviously the federal law requires us to do so. Regarding the rebasing, I think that is almost more a question for the department as to whether or not they think they can time these together. We've been talking about the possibility, and I just throw this out, is there maybe we would consider a floor or a ceiling so that no hospital was a net winner or net loser too much in the first year. And then we would phase that in and perhaps then move to it in the second year. And I know that that is another level of complexity, but then at least the hospitals would be able to adjust or know about it so that it didn't start for them overnight. And I don't want to put the department, we're just kind of talking about that now. I don't know that.
Representative Abler.
Just briefly. Well, I think that, you know, the hospital association has to lobby on behalf of its hospitals, and you've got quite a broad array of hospitals, shall we say. Mm-hmm. And so getting a consensus out of those folks has got to be an interesting little annual meeting. But so, Mr. Chair, I think we should just consider delaying the rebasing. This is something to talk about, and if we think of it, then Ms. Krinke has to go back and report it about it that, gee, they maybe want to delay the whole thing. If there's going to be big losers, and there are going to be some groups come up, and it's going to be one of our hospitals, and you're like, holy cow, and they're going to be at risk of closing because of this, because nobody can predict what this is. And you do your little up and down floor thing. You really have none rebasing anyway if you have a little window. And that way, the safe harbor, if we did it like, I'm just thinking out loud, but if you did it come 2015, you know, they're late anyway. But so by the time they got to it, it'd be February of 15. But then, you know, the safe harbor of whoever being here doing something that's to guard against some harm, it's a budget year, and you can do a little tweak and soft land somebody. Just a thought. I'll leave it at that. But I think we might save somebody from their own political pressures and the department from the pressure to follow the law, which they already are at least 3 months off schedule anyway. So,
okay, any other questions? Thank you, Ms. Krinke.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just one last comment. We really do want to move forward, though, on the readmissions buyback. That's the most important. Thank you.
Thank you. Eric Hauge. Welcome to the committee.
Good evening, members. My name is Eric Hauge with AFSCME Council 5. Thanks for this quick opportunity to testify about the governor's 2014 supplemental budget. 2013 was a real monumental year for Minnesota, with long overdue investments made in services for the most vulnerable, thanks to you. The budget passed last year really set the state on a path for success, and we think 2014 is a year to build on those investments while ensuring a strong foundation for the state's financial success. We support most of what's in the governor's proposal, a rate increase for home and community-based services and the employees working in those settings, community addiction recovery enterprise funding to ensure solvency in this important state function, and critical staffing supports for state-operated services and the Minnesota Sex Offender Program to ensure client care and staff safety. Recognizing that 2014 isn't the year to make major policy decisions with regards to long-term investments, we do hope to engage with the governor and this committee in the next couple short months about other areas we can invest in, such as funding for our hospital and safety net system, supports for our state's child care providers with the rollout of Parent Aware, and resources to ensure that our counties can deliver the services their residents rely on. So I look forward to these continued discussions, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Could you get me the numbers? You know, I had a meeting with some of your folks here a week ago, about the number of people at the state, not the state-operated services, but at the St. Peter Security Hospital, the number of your employees that end up in emergency rooms because one of the patients beat the hell out of them.
Yeah,
absolutely. I sort of remember the numbers, but it was, I think it was around 30% for the whole facility, and for one particular part of that facility, it was like 100%. ended up in the emergency room.
Absolutely, Mr.
You could give me those numbers, I'd appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Any other questions? Thank you for your testimony. Is David Godfrey still here? I saw him earlier.
I'm here for David and I.
Okay.
I think we're after another testifier.
Alice
Holbert
is first.
Yep. Oh, I didn't see that one. Alice Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'm Alice Holbert. I'm one of the volunteer members of the State Quality Council. So I'm here to whine also and just see if we could come up with $2 million somewhere from the budget. As a person who has a 29-year-old son who's living in a group home, I can say that quality is the most important thing for us. Licensing and abuse and neglect, we don't even want to go there. We want to be sure that the programs that we have are high quality and working well. And as family members, we don't really have a way to do that. There is no Angie's List that we can check out for providers of long-term care. So it's really important for us to come up with a system to know that all the money that's going into performance improvement and the new efforts with Men Choices and the rate paying and 245D, we're doing so many things at once, but we don't seem to have anything in place to make sure that we're getting the results that we should be for that investment. So I'm thinking that you, as a man of science, can understand that we really need to find a way to measure our results to be sure that we're headed in the right direction. Thank you.
Thank you. And I have to joke about this, but I have a severe handicap being a legislator, and that's that I understand the difference between cause and correlation and the difference between one standard deviation from the mean and two standard deviations. Mm-hmm. And that's a real handicap around here, I'm telling you.
Mr. Chair, and that the plural of anecdote is not data.
Mr. Chair, I think as lawyers we have a similar problem. We think we can make the objection that somebody on the opposing side is argumentative and that maybe the chair should sustain those or that there might be evidence to back up assertions. But the reason I raise my hand is I think you're advocating, not whining. And even though it's repetitive advocacy and sometimes not as successful as you'd like it to be, I think it's important advocacy.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Nope, I don't see any. Thank you. Barbara Cox is filling in for David Godfrey. And, okay, you're on the agenda, so.
Yeah.
Okay, welcome, because I don't think you represent Hampton County Medical Center, do you?
No, but we're partners. Hi, I'm Barbara Cox from Regents Hospital, a part of the Health Partners Family at Care, and I'm here tonight without my partner from HCMC, David Godfrey, to talk about emergency medical assistance. And we were really disappointed that the governor's budget did not contain funding for this coverage program. The department in January issued a report. I have a copy of it here, and I can send you all a link if you'd like to read all 61 pages. But it's a great report because it talks about the importance of coverage for this this population. And it makes a number of recommendations. They're listed on page 13. And the recommendations are to provide limited coverage to certain remaining uninsured populations. In the report, in the appendixes, there are letters from a number of organizations that participated in the RFI, and those organizations include Legal Aid, the Safety Net Coalition, Ramsey County, AFSCME, Optum Health, the Long-Term Care Imperative, the Hospital Association, and Regions and HCMC. EMA is a federally mandated program which serves people who have life-threatening conditions who cannot access other public programs. The restricted benefit set that's been in place since 2012 has created tremendous disruption in the lives of patients and families. For instance, people who have been forced to to leave nursing facilities and be readmitted to hospitals because their nursing facility benefit was no longer covered. A number of the 60 children served by children's hospitals who are on the EMA program because of terminal or life-threatening illnesses now have to be admitted for inpatient stays to receive their medications. They don't receive them in an outpatient setting, as would be better care. The changes that were made to the EMA benefit set in 2012 have moved the program in the exact opposite direction from Minnesota's other state public programs. In the EMA program, the state is paying for higher cost care, inappropriate care, by directing more and more patients to the emergency department or inpatient hospitalization. In short, the program is not providing care that's good for the patient, nor is the program providing good value to the taxpayers of Minnesota. Given this gap in the state's coverage, we hope that the committee will consider Representative Moran's bill, House File 2677, that introduces a limited benefit set for this population. The department's recommendations, again, are in this report, and the bill, though we understand you have a lot of requests before your committee, also provides a modest increase in financial support to community clinics, community mental health centers, and dental clinics so that they can continue to serve the remaining uninsured. Thanks for considering funding this critical gap in coverage.
Thank you. Other questions for Ms. Cox? I don't see any, so thank you. And next we have Pete Thielen. We had questions this morning about the Andrew residents.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am Peter Thielen. I'm the Director of Program Services at Andrew Residence in downtown Minneapolis. And I'm here to hopefully tell you a little bit about who we are, what we do, and how we came to be a line item in the governor's budget. We're unique in that we're certified both as a nursing facility by the State Department of Health, and we're a mental health treatment program and licensed by the Department of Human Services. So we swim really at the confluence of long-term care and mental health. We're also Joint Commission accredited as a behavioral health care organization. We're a five-story brick building. We look like a nursing home, but we care for people who on average age are about 50, but range in age really from 20 to 75. We've been in existence for 40 years. We provide services to people who are experiencing serious and persistent mental illness, primarily schizophrenia. Many of our clients are under court-ordered treatment. A significant number of them, about 20%, have been adjudicated as mentally ill and dangerous. Many of them, or most all of them, have spent significant time at St. Peter. They've been stabilized in a transitional care setting there, and then they've been discharged to our setting where we provide ongoing services to them. Many of our residents also have physical health problems, including diabetes, mobility impairments, cancer, and cardiovascular disease. As I said, a lot of our residents come from St. Peter. The other setting that our clients usually come to us from would be the acute psychiatric settings of like Hennepin County Medical Center and the other local hospitals that have psych units. For the people that we serve, we really are the least restrictive setting possible. We've got a strong track record of really providing high-quality care. Our quality indicator scores and our resident quality of life and resident satisfaction scores are amongst the best in the state. The Department of Human Services, which gives us star ratings, gives us their highest five-star rating. Since the mid-90s, we have been in the group residential housing program. That was a determination that was made at that time by the department. And since that time, so over 20 years, the formula that we've used for reimbursement has been where the medical assistance rate is used to adjust the group residential housing rate. So in years when there was an adjustment up in the medical assistance rate, we saw a corresponding increase in our group residential housing rate. In years when it was cut, when MA was cut, we saw a corresponding cut in our group residential housing rate. My understanding is that last year the department went through an audit, and at that time they determined that the statutory language did not clearly support the practice that had been in place for the past 20-some years. So that's why I find myself here today explaining why we are in the governor's budget. Our MA rate is roughly $133 a day. I have a block away from us a nursing facility for the same case mix. Level of care for someone who has behavioral problems is $151 a day, roughly $20 more than we get per day. Any alternative, appropriate alternative care setting for this population would be significantly more expensive. We're significantly less expensive than any of the settings that our clients come to us from, and generally speaking, anywhere where our clients are discharged to are more expensive. This money simply keeps our current rates in place, and it's what is minimally needed to provide the level of care and service that this population needs.
What's the dollar amount that in the governor's budget?
I asked someone from the department to answer that, but I think that it's roughly $700,000.
Okay, good. Thank you. Any questions? Representative Abler.
It's just amazing they find something 20 years old like this to mess with. And so probably you're the highest supplemental rate GRH thing in the state. Is that
fair? I believe that's true.
Yeah, and probably a good value at that. But I was this then taken out of the forecast? And are you not getting paid now?
We are being paid. There was a meeting that took place last fall when the rates did not go forward, and we were not getting paid the new rates. And at that time, it was determined that the statutory language didn't comport that we would get paid those rates because we needed it to continue to function, but that the department would seek language this legislative session to make sure that the current language comported with what their past practice has been.
Yeah. So, Mr. Chair, I think this is a good thing. I think anybody minds what you're asking for here, but I just trying to understand the mechanics. And so you're probably getting the base GRH rate of 800-something per person officially in the forecast. Maybe Mr. Bird would know. So in the forecast, does it show that at some point we quit paying them the full price and then there was a reduction in GRH that would have gone out that we now have to buy back? Is that the mechanics?
Mr. Berg.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I think not. Mr. Thielen said, there was, when it came to light that this was going to that this was occurring, DHS met with them and there was a decision that they would continue to get the rate they were receiving, and the chairman received a letter in July or August thereabouts from the commissioner saying that this had come to their attention and that they would be continuing to pay the existing rate and seeking legislative authority to make that backed up in the statute. If we were to not pass that, I think the department would then be in the position of actually having to change the rate.
Yeah. And so, Mr. Chair, I'm just trying to find a way to save you having to pay for this. And so, if it's 700 grand, you know, the biennium, it's $1.5 million next year, next biennium. And so, I mean, just to make sure they've got their math right. If they didn't put it in the forecast, you don't have to pay for it. But if they did recapture the money in the out biennium or something. That's just for later on, but thank you for the work you do, and we'll just noodle on the math here later. So how many standard deviations away from the mean would this be, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Thielen, if I could ask you a question. The people in this residency, and I understand you have 200 beds.
212.
Okay. And are they allowed out, or are they in there permanently? I mean, can they go out and walk around in the streets? Or
some people can, and some people do. It depends on their level of vulnerability and the assessment that we've done with them and what agreements they have with the court, with the case management. Some people don't leave, or are physically unable to leave, and other people take a bus pass. Some people go to work, part-time jobs and the like.
Thank you. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As we're just learning about this, what's the average length of stay? Does this tend to be a long-term placement for people? Given their serious diagnosis, do most tend to stay the remainder of their days, or what's the prognosis for most of your people?
Mr. Thielen.
Mr. Chair, ma'am, the average length of stay, we're one of the few facilities where someone could stay long term. As the state has moved to settings, what had been small group homes for people with mental illness now have become primarily 90-day stay facilities. So we are working with people who are at the sicker end of the continuum, for whom other settings haven't worked out, and many of our people are there for the long term. We do have people who are there for 3 to 6 months, stabilize their illness, and move on to a more independent setting. But yes, to your question, the majority of the people are there for the long term. They are assessed on a regular basis by state and county people to determine whether or not they continue to need that level of care or whether they could go to a less restrictive setting.
Thank you.
And there was a question this morning. Is your organization a non-for-profit, or what is your organization?
We are a for-profit organization. However, as I pointed out in my testimony, there is a not-for-profit facility a block away that gets a rate $20 higher than we do each day. And I've worked in the not-for-profit setting, and I've worked in the for-profit setting, and we behave like a not-for-profit.
That's what I would guess. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if you're a for-profit entity, who owns the organization?
The organization is owned by Karen Floyd, who's the executive director. The organization has a history of 4 years ago being a small mom-for-pop, transitioning to a larger corporation, and a Fortune 500 corporation, and then becoming again a mom-and-pop single owner. Because none of the for-profit chains found it to be a particularly profitable entity and walked away from it.
So, Mr. Chair?
Representative Liebling.
I'm sorry, couldn't quite understand the name. What's the name of the person?
Karen Foy, F-O-Y.
F-O-I?
Y.
F-O-Y. Thank you.
Okay, other questions? Thank you for your testimony.
You're welcome.
Is there anybody in the audience that would like to testify? Don't see any. So, do we have minutes?
Yes, we do.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler moves the minutes.
I'd like to be the one to have the honor of moving the minutes on Tom Huntley Day.
Any discussion of the minutes? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, so the minutes are adopted.
You don't get very many Tom Huntley days. Yeah, I would like to work with as much as I can. I've worked several for you.
So I guess with that, the meeting is adjourned.